brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about the banksters who are still screwing the little guys. More than 4 years after the massive economic collapse caused by the Wall Street greed monsters and the greedy banksters, we're still seeing people losing their homes. Tonight we're going to talk to a victim of this housing heist. And I go back to the Romney campaign. I go back to one of the things he said about, well, you know, we just kick those people out of their homes, get investors in there. Good business solution. And you see reports out that, you know, the banks are spending more money kicking people out of their houses and reselling them for less money than actually into making sure that people stay in their house. Something seriously wrong with that. Also going to talk about another reason for the French to hate, well, to hate us Americans. But this one, this reason, I think I absolutely agree with. We have given too much power, too much influence to these overstuffed, narcissistic egomaniacs, and they've used desperation as their tool to tear workers apart. You'll be amused, amazed, and really, I think, angry about a CEO and what he said about the French workers. And understand, that's the race to the bottom. So we're going to talk about that. Also, the minimum wage debate is coming up again. And like nearly 7 years ago when we were fighting it right here in Pennsylvania, I said back then, I want it to be indexed. So we don't have to have these fights every couple of years, or in this case, 7 years later. You know, I think about the mother or the family trying to survive. Just survive. It's pathetic. And it needs to be addressed immediately. And for me, it's another reason, you know, having seen the minimum wage basically eroded away by inflation over the last several years, this is another reason why we need to have strong labor unions, so that they push and they fight. And you look at all, and I've been saying this for a while, you look at all the attacks that have gone on over the last couple of years against labor. And, you know, I've been saying for a while, it's about keeping them distracted. You know, a lot of these fights that they start fires. The business community or the radical right, they start these fires and labor has to put them out. This way they're distracted away from doing the other things like fighting for better conditions on the job, fighting for better wages. And this is another example. I mean, it's been 7 years since they last raised the minimum wage. 2006 is when the last one. Also going to talk about the budget talks that have wrapped up for now, where we're going to go with the budget here in Pennsylvania, what the priorities are and what they should be. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the show at rick@thericksmithshow.com. So it was like deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra used to say. Scott Walker gave his State of the State address there in Wisconsin. And much like our guy here, I'm going to give tax breaks away and cut education funding and claim that they're balancing budgets. I look at Walker, what he said last night. He said, I am pleased to announce an income tax cut of $343 million. He said, you, the hardworking taxpayers of the state, helped create the budget surplus. So it's only right that we put the money back into your hands. And over the next decade, this will lower income taxes $1.7 billion. He said, overall, our budget includes more than $630 million in tax cuts. So I look at this and I go, well, you know, they're cutting education funding. That was part of his speech. I'm going to expand the voucher plan that we know doesn't work. I'm going to freeze any state support of municipalities or city level programs, frozen all that. So again, that trickled down where the state government's walking away from the local. This way that the tax increases don't look like it's going in their watch, but you know, the local people getting screwed. And he also doubled down on the refusal to take the Medicaid expansion money, like our governor. So at least there'll be two of them. As most Republican governors are going, well, we better do it because, not because it's the right thing, they would never do that, but because it means jobs, it means insuring people, and it means probably being reelected. seems reasonable. But I look at this frame, and it caught my eye when he said, you know, this budget surplus, you know, we've created this budget surplus. And I immediately hearkened back to 2000. Because for those of you who remember 2000, the economy was doing pretty well. We had a pretty decent unemployment rate. People found jobs. We were looking at a debt-free nation. I mean, we had surpluses as far, projected as far as the eye could see. Going to pay that debt off. The Alan Greenspans of the world, you know, minds empty. You had no idea. We have no idea what it's going to be like to be debt-free. We're paying the debt off too fast. Have no idea. That didn't last long. Because in came George W. Bush with the same rhetoric. Budget surpluses that we've projected, we're going to give them back. With this blind faith belief that, oh, you know, it's going to create jobs. Because, you know, the $343 million he says he's going to give back to the taxpayers, that's, you know, what, a little over half of the $630 million he's going to give away. So where's the rest going, cronies? And if you look at, if you break it down, you know, a family who makes $80,000 a year would see only about an extra $8 a month in their pocket. I don't know that that extra $8 a month is going to set the world on fire. I don't know that that extra $8 in consumption is going to could undo all the damage that Walker has done. What I do know is by cutting funding for education, what I do know is cutting funding for infrastructure, cutting investments in our future because, oh, we have these budget surpluses and, oh, we're not going to invest them because we've got our political agenda. It's going to harm us long term. And I look at this story that I just came across before coming on air over at Penn Live. They wrote it this afternoon. The Patriot had this story about the Harrisburg infrastructure problem. They're saying as a nation we're the land of sinkholes and bursting water mains. Why? Because we haven't invested in it. And you look over on Cameron Street here in Harrisburg, where they just had a water main break. I think it was Tuesday night it happened. Much like the sinkhole because of the aged infrastructure in town. The water main, and this just, you know, again, it goes to how we have not upgraded and how we have not rebuilt our infrastructure. The water main was put in place in 1884. I mean, think about that. 1884. The last time we said, you know what, we need to have water coming through our pipes and into our homes. And gets me is you look at Harrisburg's broke. There's no revenue here. They're not going to be able to invest in upgrading that. So you're going to see a spiraling down even further because the state's not going to do it. Because look what they're doing to all the municipalities across the state anyway. And you've got the people who are the heads of of the Harrisburg city government saying, well, all we can do is fix what breaks. When it breaks, we'll fix it. That's all we can do. And maybe, you know, we'll replace those that are going to go if we can. But it's not just a Harrisburg thing. You know, the article points out that the EPA claims there are at least 650 water main breaks each and every day in this country. And those pipes, 1870s, 1880s, and I started thinking about this. You know, you think about investing in the future. And I was thinking about the water main, you know, 1884. That's how long it's been in the ground. Someone made that investment back in 1884 and said, you know what, we're going to forego consumption right now so that we can invest in this, we can have this, we can invest in the future and have it for, well, about 130 years. And what are we talking about, though? Well, we're gonna give away the, we've created this imaginary surplus there in Wisconsin, and they're gonna, well, we're gonna give it away. And not in, and it just blows my mind how short-sighted we have been. How short-sighted we have become and say, well, you know, we don't need to fix our infrastructure. And the governor's plan was pathetic. If you listen to his State of the State address, pathetic. Saying, oh, we have a $6.5 billion need, but we're going to put $1.8 billion at it over the next 5 years. That's not even going to keep us anywhere near fixing our problems. But what we are doing, we're making sure the well-heeled, the well-to-do, well-to-do. And like we talked about last night, the study from the guy at the Congressional Research Service is Thomas Hungerford, who said, you know what, you know, one of the biggest drivers of inequality? Our tax system, the capital gains structure, the dividends, that we've created a system where there are two types of income, the ones you work for and the ones you gamble on. And it strikes me as very interesting that now we have an infrastructure that's in trouble, an education system that's underfunded, and a future that, I got to be honest, is not as bright as I would like to see. What are we doing for the next generation? And, you know, I go back to my grandparents who, you know, they were proud of the country that they left us. They were proud of the fact that they built a strong, burgeoning middle class, that they built an environment where people had opportunity. They invested in their kids' future and in their grandkids' future. But yet the political leaders we've got now, they're so short-sighted, I got to get reelected, I got to make it to the next election. I don't care about 20 or 30 or 50 years down the road, I care about today. And we've been sold that for the last 30 years. Carpe diem, they say. Well, what's it gotten us? We've been saying that for 30 years, and for 30 years, we have seen a mass redistribution of wealth. I shouldn't even say that, a massive theft. And the statistics, the studies, all of that's out there. The wealth in this country is concentrated in the hands of a very few, and the crumbs, well, the crumbs are what we fight over. And they make sure they throw out the divisive issue every now and again to keep us at each other's throats so we don't realize it's really all about the money. And, you know, some of the things that have come out recently, that if you're not outraged and angry about what corporate America and both political parties have done, I don't know what's going to get to you. And over the next couple of months, we'll be talking about the budget and our governor's budget. Nothing to be happy about there, in my view. Unless you're an oil company or unless you're, you know, a big corporation who can use loopholes and can get tax handouts. For the vast majority of us, nothing good there. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Senator Judy Schwenk about the budget and where we need to go. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
What could end up being one of President Barack Obama's biggest decisions this year has the progressive movement divided. At some point this spring, it's expected that the president will finally give a thumbs up or thumbs down to the Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline transports synthetic crude oil from the oil sands region of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in the United States. The XL pipeline is intended to expand on that distribution. Obama has opposed building the pipeline near the Sand Hills region of Nebraska due to the potential environmental impact, but in March of 2012, he endorsed the building of the second part near Cushing, Oklahoma. Organized labor has been mostly on board with building the pipeline, with the primary concern being how and where it's built. Last year, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka told C-SPAN that he believed labor was mostly unanimous in the effort to build the pipeline.
I think we're all unanimous by saying we should build the pipeline, but we have to do it consistent with all environmental standards. And I think we can work that out. I really do. And we are for that happening.
Last week, AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department President Sean McGarvey joined in on a conference call hosted by the American Petroleum Institute to reiterate support by the AFL, especially now that the pipeline's trajectory has been shifted in Nebraska. McGarvey stressed that the pipeline would provide much-needed jobs in the construction industry. Even as labor expresses support for the pipeline, thousands of progressives have stressed that there are a myriad of other reasons to oppose the pipeline's expansion. Wynn's Melinda Tuhus attended the Forward on Climate rally in Washington, D.C. on Sunday.
Van Jones took the stage near the start of the rally. He worked in Obama's White House on green jobs and now works with Rebuild the Dream.
President Obama, all the good that you have done, all the good you can imagine doing, will be wiped out by floods, by fires, by superstorms, if you fail to act now to deal with this crisis that is a gun pointed at the head of the future.
Two Native women from Canada spoke about the environmental and public health damage that's already been wreaked on their Indigenous lands and peoples by TransCanada's process of extracting the tar sands. They're trying to stop another pipeline through British Columbia for exporting tar sands to Asia. Grace Horvath is a high school junior from Virginia who attends a science and math academy. She said when she heard about the rally, she did some research on the Keystone XL pipeline.
It doesn't benefit us directly except maybe creating jobs, but I don't see why those jobs aren't being created with wind and solar energy.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I know many of you are going to be interested in this next subject. Pennsylvania sits within a day's drive of 60% of the nation's population. Every year, nearly $500 billion worth of goods and services move through our state transportation system. Transportation is the bloodstream of our economy. If it fails, our economy fails. However, as you know, the average bridge in our state is 51 years old.
I gotta wonder, and I've said this, you know, since the moment the governor said that, my first response is, well, what's it gonna take for him to actually invest in infrastructure? Maybe part of his motorcade to be swallowed up by one of the numerous sinkholes in sinkhole city known as Harrisburg. What's it gonna take? I mean, the latest one over on Cameron Street, 1884, is when they put those pipes in that are and now they failed. 1884. I think you get over 100 years out of something. You probably got your money's worth. You should have probably reinvested in it at some point in the last, I don't know, 20 years. Just a thought. But you know, here again, he's right, and I don't often say that about our governor. If our infrastructure fails, we fail. So to me, his plan, $1.8 billion over the next 5 years on a $6.5 billion need, is another failure, which is why I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Judy Schwenk to come talk to us about the big budget negotiations. Senator Schwenk, thanks for taking time for me.
Hello, how are you?
I'm happy I haven't fallen in a sinkhole. As I saw, and we're thinking about doing a walking tour of the city of Harrisburg, making sure that people aren't too close because we don't want to get swallowed up. 41 sinkholes in the last year in the city of Harrisburg.
Not surprising.
Well, what's not surprising is it hasn't happened sooner, and you look at the fact that we haven't been investing, in my opinion, maybe you've got a different thought on this, we haven't been investing nearly enough in our future, in our infrastructure, in education, in healthcare. Just not enough, in my view.
I would agree with you, Rick. I mean, how many plans do we have to do? How many blue ribbon commissions till we finally agree? Because, you know, we've got some formulas, some funding formulas that we can use. We need to go for it.
And, you know, I get a number of emails from these very well-funded Pennsylvania-based right-wing think tanks created for propaganda purposes, and they've come up with this new cliff that we've got because evidently Representative Gene DiGirolamo, a Republican from Bucks County, said that we need to spend some money on human services.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, there's been this thing called the welfare cliff. I don't know if you've heard of it. what is it about the right and these cliffs and this kind of verbiage? It just blows my mind.
It's alarmist, and truly what we've got to do is sit down, roll up our sleeves, and figure this out. Because we've got a lot of problems, not just transportation, of course. We've got to look at education. We've got to look at health care, the Medicaid expansion issue. There's so many things we need to be talking about. And this budget has a lot of moving parts, Rick. It's, you know, a lot of things that, you know, one thing hinges on the other, whether, you know, we get the pension reforms that the governor would like to have probably predicates what our education funding will look like. The sale of the liquor stores could possibly generate money for special educational programs, but we're only going to get it if we privatize the liquor stores. It's a budget of false choices, I think.
Yeah, I mean, for me, those are both non-starters because they don't make any sense.
No.
I mean, you know, what is it about, you know, about some that want me to work for poverty wages and want to make workers poor? I mean, it just boggles the mind. And in the process, ruins our economy. I mean, all we have to do is look across the pond at Europe and see that austerity does not work.
Absolutely. I mean, on the liquor store privatization, you know, obviously when you're referring to, you know, putting people out of work, this would certainly hurt our the individuals who are working for the liquor stores. Beer distributors are just about going to be wiped out in Pennsylvania because most of them will not be able to afford the high license fees associated with the expansion. And, you know, I represent the city of Reading, where we have just had a crime summit because of all the violent crime that we've experienced in our community. The last thing we need is more liquor available, you know, more outlets to buy liquor in our city. Nuisance bars are a big problem for us.
Yeah, but, you know, that's how our governor thinks we're going to fund education. Shots for tots, booze for books, whatever you want to call it, liquor for stickers, whatever. That's the gimmick. That's the scheme. And what bothers me is it seems that our governor and the folks that support him want to fund programs for our most vulnerable and our next generation, either education or senior programs or any off of vice gimmicky spending off of these privatization schemes, instead of just saying, you know what, these are important priorities for the future of our commonwealth, for the future of the nation. We should be doing this as a matter of course, not as a gamble, not as a, hey, let's see who's going to get liquored up. We should be doing it as a matter of course.
I would agree with you on that. It's as if, you know, you can get these wonderful things, but only if you go along with these programs that the governor is proposing. I don't get it, because these are things that, as our leader, he should be trying to find a way with the legislature on how we make some of these things happen in Pennsylvania. Our future depends upon it. Why are we gambling with education funding? This is way too important.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, I look at this and I keep hearing the frame, and I get a bunch of people telling me, you know, Rick, we're broke. We don't have any money, you know, but we sure seem to have a lot of money to be giving away, through that magical box over there in Delaware. And we seem to have an awful lot of money to be giving, big corporations for a plant that they were probably going to build anyway. We seem to have a lot of that. It tells me we've got a priority problem.
I would agree with that. You know, we're always given the story, and I'd like to believe it were true. I believe in fostering business. I think that's extremely important. But some of the things that have been promised to us as a result of that, the more jobs, some of those things just simply aren't happening. We need to do some things as a government to help create jobs as well, rather than just waiting for these things to happen.
I'm right there with you.
And that includes things like job training. Those are the things that we didn't hear about in this budget. The business site development, our brownfields, remediating them and getting them ready for new industries to come in, particularly in our cities. We're just not hearing anything.
And I think the big one, I mean, the governor, he admitted in his speech, we're within a day's drive of 60% of the population. We are, you know, when business wants to locate, it wants to move to a place, what are the first three things they look for? Location, location, location.
Right.
And then they look for education and transportation. All things that, you know, you go education, $2 billion slashed over the last 2 years. Our transportation funding on his own commission's needless, $6.5 billion he's going to put $1.8 over the next 5 years. That, to me, is not business friendly. I'm with you. Foster business, but do it the right way, not with handouts, but with good education and good infrastructure.
It seems to me that would be the path we ought to be taking, but unfortunately we're not. But I'd say the good thing is we're just beginning. You know, I'm sitting on the Appropriations Committee. We're having these hearings now, talking with different agencies, you know, trying to understand what their priorities are and how we can help, you know, fix some of these things.
Anything surprise you to this point?
Nothing yet, but we're just starting. Well, this was just our first week. We're going to get into, you know, some of the more significant agencies like Education, Department of Public Welfare, which I hope we change the name to the Department of Human Services. I think that would be a far better name for it. No surprises yet, but there's certainly going to be some tough discussions as we meet with some of those departments.
Yeah, and looking at the budget, you know, the last two have been extraordinarily painful. You know, I look to the fact that the last time around they eviscerated the general assistance budget, cutting some 70,000 of the most vulnerable off completely. And I wonder what's in store for this budget cycle.
Well, I think some of that remains to be seen. I mean, if you certainly go to the issue of Medicaid expansion, which a lot of us have been talking about, we don't have a clear understanding of why the governor is not accepting this. I suppose you heard today that Governor Rick Scott from Florida, another Republican governor, has said, this is what my people need. This is what I'll do. What I don't get, this isn't about poor people. This is really about the new poor. This is for the people that are working two or three jobs who don't have health care coverage, who really, you know, are 1 week or two away from destitution. They're living paycheck to paycheck, and having some kind of major illness could devastate them. It's about preventive care. It's about making sure that we pay for health care in the most effective way, not when people walk through the emergency room door.
You know, is it something you think that's just ideological, or is it chafed over having lost his lawsuit and spent millions of Pennsylvania tax dollars pursuing a lawsuit that most people said was never going to go anywhere, or is it just pure politics?
I have to think that some of it is driven by ideology, again, because we haven't been able to see the numbers. And that was a point that was made the other day to Secretary Zogby, Secretary of the Budget. We really want to understand, you know, why you're saying that this is ultimately going to cost us so much more. Because of the work that we've done on it, we haven't been able to see it yet. So, you know, I'm certainly, we can be proven wrong, of course, but we've got to have the numbers. We've got to be able to work on this together. Too important to too many people.
Well, absolutely, because I know people who are uninsured who want this in the worst way, because I truly don't believe that you can be anywhere near the middle class without some measure of health security, that, you know that if I get sick, I'm not going to lose everything that I've worked for. And the sad reality is, for far too many, that's the reality. One sickness, one illness, one unexpected, hey, I fell and broke my leg, that's it. You're in trouble.
Exactly.
And what does that say about the richest nation on the planet, that, you know, we're spending so much money on health care costs, twice as much as the rest of the industrialized world, and yet we're leaving 50 million uninsured and 100 million underinsured?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. There's got to be a humane and sensible way to get to this. And I'm hopeful we'll find that.
I mean, my problem is, I think what's going on in the ideology of it is we've got to pay the homage to the profiteers. I mean, at some point, when you brought up Rick Scott, he took it because he could privatize it so that there would be profit to be made off of that somewhere. Even though the pilot program he's been using has been a failure, he took it, and we'll see what the profiteers make out of it down there. And that's kind of what bothers me about this governor. You know, for my Republican listeners, you should be angry that he has said he's not going to set up an exchange and he's going to take the federal program, because, you know, the right, they tell me they're 10th Amendment supporters, states' rights. You've just abdicated your responsibility and your power.
I would agree. I would think that it would be far better for us to tailor a program to the needs of Pennsylvania by doing that ourselves. That really was hard for me to understand how we arrived at that decision. But probably what bothers me more is this Medicaid expansion issue.
Pennsylvania
is going to be left behind, and Pennsylvania's people will be left behind.
And here again, you go back to what you said about fostering business. I mean, this is going to be one of those things, along with location, 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 along with education, along with infrastructure, it's going to be the healthcare concerns. Because, you know, if other states are using this exchange and they're doing it the right way and they're benefiting their citizens so that employers don't have to carry the burden of healthcare, which I don't think they should have to, I don't think they should want to, and I don't want them to do, they would be able to create jobs if that burden wasn't on their back.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this would, you know, in Pennsylvania, we have so many great hospitals. We are the state of EDS and MEDS. So, you know, we have teaching hospitals, universities. This could really explode that healthcare industry as far as jobs go, too. Up and down the line from, you know, research all the way down to the people that are in the first line of care. Just, you know, I see it also as a job creation issue.
Yep. And you would think, I mean, like a lot of this stuff, to me, if I'm sitting in that governor's office, if I'm sitting in that chair going, you know, how do I get reelected? Just from a purely self-centered perspective, how do I get reelected? I get reelected by getting people back to work to get the economy moved around so people feel a little bit better about themselves, a little bit better about the economy, the job I'm doing. I get reelected. To me, that's, if you have to narrow it down to very simplistic self-interest, that's it.
It's all about people, that's for sure.
So what do you see coming in the coming months? Is this something that's going to drag on to the end of June? Is this the battle? Because I can't imagine that there are an awful lot of Republicans who are going to put up with the schemes for privatizing the wine and spirit shops, or especially the lottery privatization scheme that Kathleen Kane just said that she wasn't going to sign off on. I can't imagine there's a lot of people very happy with him.
You know, I don't get the sense there's a lot of enthusiasm or a lot of defense of the budget the way that it stands, and particularly those issues, as you mentioned, of the lottery. I think that one, more than anything, is very troubling to legislators of both parties, and as well as the liquor store privatization issue. Will it really generate the funding that the governor's talking about? What about rural Pennsylvania? What about prices? What's going to happen to our microbrewery industry and some of our wineries and, you know, places where we're becoming, you know, a great place for those products? Are they going to be able to get the shelf space and, you know, the big box markets and so forth? I think what's being sold as convenience and choice is going to be, you know, far cry different.
For me,
and I think the public is really going to be surprised by that.
Well, for me, it's theft and boondoggle. I look at all of the downsides to privatizing, this whole privatization scheme, and it's going to cost me more in the long run, I truly believe, because you're going to have to enforce it. You're going to have all, not to mention all of the societal ills, all of the treatment, all of the accidents, all of the public health problems. And the 1% tax that nobody talks about that we're going to lose because, hey, you know, Walmart doesn't pay it because they pay their taxes on time.
Right, that sales tax issue. That's correct.
There are so many moving parts to this that's going to cost me down the road. And I see the biggest part for me, you know, because I am now this hypocritical creature called a parent. I don't want my kids to have the access I had. I grew up in Cleveland where you could buy liquor right there next to the Tic Tacs. It was a bad idea then. It's a bad idea here.
I'm very concerned about that, particularly if, you know, there's at least an expansion of 5,000 licenses. So that certainly means they're going to be convenience stores, you know, which generally have part-time employees, may not be as well trained in helping to card, kids that come in to try to buy beer over the counter. I'm very concerned about that.
Yeah, I think it's a bad idea. Last line of questioning I've got for you, it's on this pension issue. We keep hearing, again, more division. We're pitting teachers against kids. We're pitting taxpayers against their schools. I mean, it's a masterful job of divide and conquer, in my opinion. But what they're selling me, this whole moving over to a defined contribution plan and, you know, the heck with the next generation, doesn't work. I mean, they've tried it in other places, and it's only ended up being more costly. And for me, I mean, if you really want to get down to brass tacks, this is a huge, massive mistake because it's going to cost me twice as much in the long run.
Well, you know, at those budget hearings that I was telling you about, our treasurer, Rob McCord, did a brilliant job of dissecting the plan that's been proposed to us and the problems that will be created by it. And as you said, is going to cost us far more. One of the proposals of this, the governor's talking about, is moving those callers forward, making, you know, pushing the payment out actually a little bit further, where it's ultimately going to end up being more expensive for us.
There's
just a lot of problems with this as it's proposed.
Yeah, not to mention the people who are in the defined plan. You're going to have to shorten the amount of time you amortize this. You're going to have to shorten your expectations of interest returns. There are so many parts to this that you, me, the taxpayers, we're going to get the shaft on. But again, it's about separating people from professional services and getting everyone with that little account that they can zap fees to every quarter, and well, Wall Street makes a nice tidy profit.
It's a race to the bottom is the way that I see it. I mean, I think a lot of the, you know, our retired government employees, people who have been on defined benefit plans, they're helping to keep our economy going.
Yep.
They've got some money, you know, to help care for themselves. I see a real issue with retirement in this country, not just Pennsylvania,
in
the future.
I cannot wait till 2014. I can't wait till the next election. We get rid of this guy, bring somebody in with some sense, and maybe add some balance into the House and Senate to where you don't have one-party rule. You don't have dictatorial control. There's hope. 2014's around the corner.
Well, we're going to start working on it right now. Certainly, there's a lot to be done with this budget, and you can count on me and others. We're serious about this, and we'll be working hard to make this a better fit for all Pennsylvanians.
I appreciate it, and I'd love to have you back as this goes down the road and talk more about the budget. Thank you,
Sounds
Senator.
Great.
Thanks so much, Senator. Pennsylvania State Senator Judy Schwenk. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Just get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Have you had your minimum daily requirement of nanos today? Nanomaterials, that is, manufactured or natural substances that are broken down in high-tech facilities to be teensy-tiny, molecule-sized particles. Don't look for them on the ingredient list of food packages, because the big corporate processors of our edibles don't want us to know that their goodies include these minuscule, mysterious things that, when ingested, go to places in the body that regular foodstuffs don't directly enter, such as straight into your cells. There's been precious little research on the human health impacts of nanos, though studies have shown them having unpleasant effects on mice. Also, our food regulators have flatly and ominously said they don't have enough information even to evaluate the safety of nanomaterials. So why are they popping up in processed foodstuffs? No one is talking, except a few anonymous food manufacturers who express enthusiasm for the ability for the whatever they are to make processed foods seem creamier and to brighten food colors. A watchdog group called As You Sow sent a survey to 2,500 food manufacturers asking about their use of nanos. A whopping 26 responded, only 14 of which claimed not to use the things. The group ran its own test of 10 varieties of powdered donuts, finding that the sweet concoctions of Hostess Brands and Dunkin' Donuts had products containing a nano called titanium dioxide. What benefit does it offer? It makes white substances brighter. This is Jim Hightower saying, hello. An unknown number of corporate food profiteers are pumping an unknown amount of unknown nanomaterials straight into our cells, having an unknown impact on our health, for no better reason than to enhance the cosmetics of their products. To fight the madness, go to asyousow.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that if the full range of tax increases and spending cuts were allowed to take effect, a scenario widely referred to as the fiscal cliff, a shallow recession would occur early next year.
That's all you are to me.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. So we went from the fiscal cliff, or as I called it, the fiscal mirage, to the email I got today from the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania. Again, another one of these really well-funded right-wing attack Tea Party groups. Who, you know, wouldn't tell me who their funders are. They said, we don't have to, because the law doesn't say we have to. Nah, 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 nah. And, you know, they sent out an email today. There's now something called the welfare cliff. The welfare cliff in their little piece is where, you know, these single mothers who are making more than, say, $58,000 a year, they decide that they don't want to raise because they get government benefits. Aha, see? There's someone out there gaming the system. And, you know, the number that they use is $57,327 in income. Anything above that, then they start losing benefits. Like CHIP for the kids or, food stamps or housing assistance, heating assistance, whatever. Whatever it is, or, you know, the earned income tax credit, because they consider that part of welfare, too. Understand, the earned income tax credit, brought to us by none other than Uncle Milty Milton Friedman, pushed through by Ronald Reagan, but don't be bothered with facts. So they go into this and they say, well, you know, there's this welfare cliff, and, you know, there's this woman, we found her. In fact, there was a woman who was found by a local news station and said, you know, I'm making all this money and, you know, I can't make any more because I'll lose my benefits. And I said, you know, sometimes you're going to get somebody who's going to game the system. Here's the problem, though. Most people, the vast, vast majority of folks who need housing assistance or food stamps or CHIP for their kids or any of that stuff, most of those folks are the working poor. They're not in the $60,000 range. They're in the they're in the lower end of the spectrum. And look, you know, if all the workers were making $60,000 a year, then we could talk about doing away with some of those programs that help families. What blows my mind, though, is the same people here, the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, the same ones who advocate for more tax cuts for the very wealthy, more business-friendly policy that shifts education dollars to handouts for big multi-state multinationals. And they take, you know, simple things. Like there was a case where someone had used a food stamps in the Virgin Islands. And you know what I like about hearing about stories like that? Is because we're catching those people. See, when you hear about them, it means they got caught. Someone found it. Understand, when you stop hearing about things like that, it means we've stopped looking. Because it doesn't mean it stopped happening. And you look at the amount of fraud that's going on, extraordinarily low. But these people would want to do away with the whole system, destroy the entire system, because they want desperation. They want a desperation class of people that, well, they're easily exploitable. And they want to push this austerity down on us. They want to push this offensive on us to destroy working conditions, to destroy wages, to destroy the American middle class. And it's not just happening here. It's happening globally. You look at austerity has always been a Latin American thing. Now it's moved to Europe. Austerity is something the rest of the world knows quite well, and they know it doesn't work. And yesterday I pointed to the statement by the French president, François Hollande, who said that he rejects the European, the Europe that condemns countries to austerity without end. Yet here we are, talking about the same thing. Even though we know austerity in Europe has caused mass unemployment, we know it's made their deficits worse, we know it. We do know it works. But I look at this story that I came across in the New York Times today. In fact, a couple of people emailed it to me. And it's a CEO of a big tire plant, Titan International, evidently wrote a letter to the head of the French industry minister. And in it, because evidently the industry minister had said, hey, you know, we don't want you to close this plant. You know, we want to talk about how we get parties back to the table, make sure that we keep jobs in France, which is his job. Well, this guy, Maurice Taylor Jr., who, as the article points out, is known as the Grizz, because he is, you know, he's abrasive and he's a tough negotiator. He's a tough guy. And I guess it's kind of easy to do when we've given him so much control. But in the letter, he goes through all of this really just American business mentality. Because over in France, they have a 35-hour work week. That's it. You work 35 hours, and they make a living on 35 hours a week. That's something that I don't think we as American workers can actually grasp, that you can make a living on 35 hours a week. So this guy Taylor writes this letter, you know, basically saying, you know, you and your rules, you and your unions. He said Goodyear has tried for over 4 years to save the jobs, some of the highest paid ones, but those French unions and the French government, they did nothing. He says, how stupid do you think we are? He says, Titan is the one with the money and the talent to produce tires. What does the crazy union have? It has the French government. And he said that his company would, and this is the American way of doing things. Fine. If we can't get our way, if we can't cut your wages, if we can't increase the number of hours you're going to work, if we can't destroy your environment, if we can't do all the things that we want, because all of those things are an infringement on business, we're going to take our ball and go somewhere else. So he says in his thing that, you know, hey, we're going to take our tire production to China. We're going to take it to India. Now, we're going to pay them less than a euro an hour. We're going to pay them pennies on the dollar. And then we're going to sell those tires back here in France. And you know what? Probably he's going to be able to do it. Because we've allowed these big multinationals so much power, so much control. Then he went on to say that he believed that Michelin, which is the big tire manufacturer, the big French tire manufacturer there, he said, well, Michelin's not going to be able to compete with us because of our lower cost structure, because we're using that Chinese and that Indian labor, and that they'll be out of business in 5 years. They're not going to be able to keep up with us. And he finishes off by saying, so you can keep your so-called workers. And, you know, I look at that as kind of, look, I understand. You know, these CEOs, they don't live in our communities. They don't have any of the problems, any of the realities that average everyday worker. They don't identify at all. But you've got these big multinational CEOs who, they've got God complexes. You're going to do what you're told, and if not, we're going to crush and punish you. And this is what we have allowed through our trade agreements all around the world. And this is what the whole push towards neoliberalism has done to our globe. And I've been saying for the longest time, we need another Bretton Woods. We need another sit down where we divide the world up, put borders back in place, and redo this game over again, because it is not working for the vast majority of people on this planet. And there are some who say, well, you know, it's going to end in, just like it did the last time. It's going to end in mass war. It's going to end in mass who knows what, mass chaos. And then who ends up suffering in that? Well, of course, the working people. And what's frustrating to me on so many levels is we're the ones who have put these people into place because we bought their BS. Now, I'm reading a book right now written about the period after World War II, how the business community decided that it was time to, you know, those unions had gotten too strong. They were demanding a living wage. They were demanding health care. They were demanding some retirement security. They were demanding safe working. How dare they demand safe working conditions? They were demanding dignity. They were demanding respect. And you know, as we talked about yesterday with Irwin, people were sitting down. They're saying, you know what? We're not doing any work until we get some respect. We're going to withhold our labor. And they sent, you know, after that couple year period, they decided it's time to assault organized labor. It's time to assault working people. But we can't look like we're attacking the people. We have to attack their institutions, which is why whenever you hear the right or the business community, this guy from Titan International, whenever you hear, it's the union. It's not that collection of workers. It's not those workers. It's not those people who make our product. It's not the people who make us wealth and not the people who pay for my lavish salary. No, no. It's that evil entity that they try to divide us from. And what's angering on a number of levels is that we buy it. Because they're masters at advertising. They're masters at manipulation. They're masters at keeping it in our ear constantly. And look, in France, this got massive reaction. The newspapers there went ballistic. It's incendiary. But how much of it is, and this is where the big business understands. You know, some of the other, you know, it's insulting, it's extreme, you know, all some of the stuff that, but how much of it is, we're in their ear. We're going to they're trying to divide the French people. You know, and I hear this a lot because, and it's one of those things that just kind of, you go, what is it about us that wants us to be poor? What is it about us that wants to work for virtually nothing? And I've heard this a bunch, you know, if a big plant's going to come in, you know, you should take the low, low wage because at least you have a job. And at that mentality, you know, I could solve our unemployment problem tomorrow. Just pay everybody a buck an hour. Problem is you would not have an economy. And I look at this thing in France. And the business community, in my mind, doesn't allow this stuff to happen without a reason. So they need to make the pariah the French workers and the French unions. Because as the president pointed out as President Obama pointed out in his State of the Union address, there's going to be a U.S.-EU trade deal. They're working on it. The question is, and this is a big question for me that we're going to be talking about for the next several weeks and months until this is done, which direction do the labor laws go? Do the countries in the EU, do they follow the tradition of the U.S. NAFTA agreement, where it's the least restrictive trade barrier, which means, EU, sorry UK, sorry France, sorry Germany, your labor laws have to be destroyed. We've got to tear those down to meet the pathetic American labor laws. And then here we are, the wealthiest nation on the planet, pulling people down, leading that race to the bottom. And there are some who are saying, you know what, maybe we use this trade deal with the European Union to say, you know what, we want to rise up to better conditions. We want to make conditions better for everyone. You know, I go back to that period in this book that I'm reading. I go back to that period after World War II where they were talking about, look, you should have dignity of work. You should have dignity of health. You should have dignity of old age. You should have a right to the job. They were talking about, hey, how do we shorten the work week so that more people can be employed? And how do we make sure that you can make a living off of shorter work weeks, which is what France did? What we passed maximum hour law, 40 hours at straight time. And then you could work, you know, 150,000 hours after that at time and a half. And then they've screwed around with that. Well, we want flex time now. We want to be able to, you know, pass it off into weeks future. We'll work 100 hours this week and nothing next week. And, well, we'll figure it out. Over there, it's 35 hours a week. You need more hours, you hire more people. But that's unreasonable. What do you think? I'm stupid. I'm not going to create jobs there. That's the American view. And I'm going to be interested to see where the negotiations go because, you know, for all of the talk of the Clintonites, all of the talk of Obama and all of the talk of the Democrats, especially talking about these trade deals, is, well, we're going to lift up conditions. You know, we're going to have strong environmental and labor conditions. Well, strong for us is extraordinarily weak for most of the European Union. So the question is do we see that going down? And I sure hope not. I sure hope this is an opportunity that we can take advantage of. Anyway, I wanted to, coming up in the beginning of March, March 2nd, the Keystone Progress is going to be having their annual Pennsylvania Progressive Summit in Harrisburg. I believe it's at the Harrisburg Hilton here over on 2nd Street, 2nd and I guess that's Market. You can sign up, keystoneprogress.org, to go and see the speakers. Raul Grijalva, the representative from Arizona, will be there. Will bring his word to the Progressive Caucus from Congress. Going to be one of the speakers. Also going to have the three row officers here in Pennsylvania that won their elections. Quick break. Back with hour two of the program. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Chippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every night from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
What could end up being one of President Barack Obama's biggest decisions this year has the progressive movement divided. At some point this spring, it's expected that the president will finally give a thumbs up or thumbs down to the Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline transports synthetic crude oil from the oil sands region of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in the United States. The XL pipeline is intended to expand on that distribution. Obama has opposed building the pipeline near the Sand Hills region of Nebraska due to the potential environmental impact. But in March of 2012, he endorsed the building of the second part near Cushing, Oklahoma. Organized labor has been mostly on board with building the pipeline, with the primary concern being how and where it's built. Last year, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka told C-SPAN that he believed labor was mostly unanimous in the effort to build the pipeline.
I think we're all unanimous by saying we should build the pipeline, but we have to do it consistent with all environmental standards. And I think we can work that out. I really do. And we are for that happening.
Last week, AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department President Sean McGarvey joined in on a conference call hosted by the American Petroleum Institute to reiterate support by the AFL, especially now that the pipeline's trajectory has been shifted in Nebraska. McGarvey stressed that the pipeline would provide much-needed jobs in the construction industry. Even as labor expresses support for the pipeline, thousands of progressives have stressed that there are a myriad of other reasons to oppose the pipeline's expansion. Wynn's Melinda Tuhus attended the Forward on Climate rally in Washington, D.C. on Sunday.
Van Jones took the stage near the start of the rally. He worked in Obama's White House on green jobs and now works with Rebuild the Dream.
President Obama, all the good that you have done, all the good you can imagine doing, will be wiped out by floods, by fires, by superstorms, if you fail to act now to deal with this crisis that is a gun pointed at the head of the future.
Two Native women from Canada spoke about the environmental and public health damage that's already been wreaked on their Indigenous lands and peoples by TransCanada's process of extracting the tar sands. They're trying to stop another pipeline through British Columbia for exporting tar sands to Asia. Grace Horvath is a high school junior from Virginia who attends a science and math academy. She said when she heard about the rally, she did some research on the Keystone XL pipeline.
It doesn't benefit us directly except maybe creating jobs, but I don't see why those jobs aren't being created with wind and solar energy.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, you know, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Our soon-to-be Treasury Secretary right there, $350,000 a year, a base salary during the year of the collapse. Didn't mention the $1 million that they gave him on the way out the door. Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate the time. Appreciate, well, the failure. Thanks you so much. And I look at this report from Bloomberg News today. They pointed out that the Bank of America's, the J.P. Chase, Morgan Chase, and a couple other banks, in the last year, they spent, if you look at the big settlement, $25 billion in foreclosure settlement, spent 19.5 of it on approving so-called short sales that let homeowners sell their properties for less than they owe on the mortgage, and only $6 billion reducing the principal to keep folks in their homes. And what it says to me, what this really, it's taking money to make sure that they get those properties back so they can sell them for a little profit. Not so much about keeping people in their homes. And if you go back to the 2012 presidential campaign, you had Mitt Romney saying what we need to do to get those people out of their homes, let the foreclosure process work, put those people to the curb, get investors in there, put those renters in there, good business solution. Good business solution. And what I've seen across the country is so many people who lose their homes, some really in big trouble, some just out and out theft in my mind. And my next guest is one of those people who the story that I've seen just looks like out and out theft to me. I've got Steve Bailey. He's a member of the Home Defenders League. One of the people who, like I said, I believe his house was stolen from him. Steve, thanks for taking time for me.
I appreciate having me on, Rick.
So walk me through this. How do you get into a situation where the bank just one day says, sorry, we're taking it?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's interesting. I'm a professional answer, but I was running my own firm at the time. And I, you know, living the American dream, owned my home, owned the, you know, owned the car, did the business, ran the business. And we were, you know, like all businesses, it would get slow at times, and we would be late on the payment, and then we would double back the next month and catch back up. Well, this happened twice. And this put us, twice. We kind of, we got about 30 days late and then caught back up. You know, but in small businesses, that happens all the time. You get to pay your bills when your invoice comes in. But so we were paying our bills, and when we called to pay the bill, the lender, Wells Fargo, the servicer, was constantly trying to solicit us into a program to try to reduce our rates and lower our payments because they saw that we were having a little trouble.
Yeah, and who could be against that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it made sense to us, but we wanted to keep with the original deal, so it took 3 or 4 months of them begging us to get into this, what they called the HAMP program. And eventually we said, yeah, fine, let's give it a shot. You know, this is our bank. They want to help us out. That's fine. So we got into a HAMP program, and the first thing they did was they said, well, we're going to set you up on a payment schedule that's a little bit lower payments, and you make 3 of these payments, and you'll prove to us that you can make those on time, and we'll modify your loan, and that'll be time of your payment.
Seems simple.
So yeah, pretty simple stuff. You know, I mean, it's kind of a government-backed program, so.
So what happened?
Well, that's the thing. They right off the bat, they said, well, your first payment is due, and it turned out it was due about 3 months from when we had agreed to go to the program. So we thought, oh, well, that's great. We got a little break. And, well, it turns out that was their way of putting us into default officially. And so we made the 3 payments as they asked, and then, of course, they claim to have lost paperwork. They claim to not have the right documentation. Excuse after excuse for not actually putting us through the program for about 7 or 8 months, and they kept just saying, "Yeah, everything's fine. You're going to get your modification. Everything's perfectly fine. Just keep paying the reduced payments."
And, so you were making the payments the whole time.
Made every payment. I made every single payment my bank asked me to make. And after about 7 or 8 months, we started getting foreclosure notices. And we couldn't understand what was going on, so we immediately called the bank, and the same people we've been dealing with, and they said, no, those are an error. Those foreclosure notices are a mistake. That's another department. They don't know that you're going for modification. Just ignore them.
Yeah, no, get me a letter saying to ignore them.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunately at the point where it's too late, because you immediately, I immediately thought, well, this is fishy, and checked my credit. Well, it turned out that they had reported to my credit agency that I had been delinquent on my mortgage payments for the last 8 months. So they completely trashed my credit. All the while, I thought I was paying my bills in full. Every payment that they had through there, they called it a payment not in full and didn't apply it to my loan. So then, like, all of a sudden, I get this bill for $15,000 due in 30 days, or I'm out, or I'm foreclosed on. So phone call with these people, very, very frustrating. I'm assured, 2 weeks prior to me being foreclosed on, I'm assured that they are not foreclosing on me. That I'm perfectly fine, that everything's great, and just keep making the payments. And then, of course, the sheriff posts the foreclosure notices on my door, and I know, okay, now I'm being lied to.
Yeah, I mean, I would. You'd have to be carrying me out of there in handcuffs at that point.
It was tough. I'll be honest. It was tough. You know, I mean, I'm running a business, and all of a sudden my clients are seeing foreclosure notices. As a small town, my home had dual entry so that I could run a business out of it. It was right downtown where everyone could see it. And, of course, my clients got nervous and started getting calls about whether I was going to be around 6 months from now. I started losing clients. And so we still at this point, though, because we had found out why they had supposedly kicked us out of our modification, we found out that it was a clerical error. They looked at my profit loss statements and my budgeting and said, hey, I have a $900 deficit every month, so there's no way you can pay the mortgage. And I said, well, how come I've paid every payment? You know, let's do the math. So I went through it with them over the phone, and it was clear. I had a $900 surplus.
So for
they
a clerical
had done the math
error.
Wrong.
So for a clerical error, you're going to lose your home, you're the investment that you've put into it, and not to mention the turmoil of your family and the heartache there for a clerical error.
Oh yeah, well it's, you know, it cost me, my daughter, she was 11 years old at the time. She's very upset, afraid she's going to have to, you know, leave the house. All of her friends are going to find out that, you know, we're getting foreclosed on. And so she'd come to me and she'd say, we're not going to get foreclosed on, Dad. Are we going to lose the house? And I would say to her over and over again, no, we're not going to lose the house. This is America. We have laws that protect us from things like this. This is just a clerical error. We'll go down to the court and explain what's going on, explain how they've kind of defrauded us and dual-tracked us and gave us a run around and just show the receipts that say we've made every payment and we'll keep our home. And I promised her. I said, you're not gonna lose your home. And we went down. It was end of July 2010, we went down to the courthouse, and we had everything documented. We had a 3-inch stack of papers, fully itemized. We had kept everything. We had it fully itemized, and we had a summary, and we had everything in triplicate, and we had copies for the court and for the opposing attorney, for ourselves. And we went into the clerk, and we knew we were going to save our home because, hey, we're protected by laws.
You're on the right side.
Feel like your home. Well, we went in, and the clerk of court, she listened to us for about 10 minutes and said, oh, my gosh, this is just horrible. We've got to do something about this. And then the opposing attorney, the attorney for the bank, it was Wachovia, you could tell he got nervous. So he reaches down into his briefcase, and he pulls out a single sheet of paper. And it turns out that piece of paper was his affidavit, his statement that said that the bank had the right to foreclose and that everything was in order. And the clerk of the court turns to me and says, Mr. Bailey, I am no longer allowed by law to consider any of the evidence. If you're a day late or a dollar short, you're foreclosed on.
And they did this.
I lost my house.
They did this without, they went through the foreclosure process and you were in there to defend yourself.
Well, they went through the foreclosure process on the fly. They went through, so they call this dual tracking, where they'll keep you making all the payments, and you think that you're making all the payments and that you're perfectly fine and that you're current on your account. But what they're doing is they're not applying the money that you make your payments in directly to the loan. They're keeping now that into sort of a trust.
Man, that's
they're saying, okay, well, until we get a payment in full, we haven't gotten a payment.
But they told you not to make the payment full. They reduced it. They reduced
exactly
what it is they told you to pay.
Exactly. It is fraud. It is, by definition, fraud. If you or I did that to anyone else, we would be in prison.
Yeah, but I think what we've learned throughout this entire crisis is what Wall Street does, what these big banksters do, there's no law for them. They're above the law because we've allowed them to get too big.
Yeah, well, and I mean, how do I explain that to my daughter? I mean, my daughter...
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
Comes to me later and is asking me about, you know, questions about life and how things are going to work. And I try to give her my wisdom. And she turns to me and she says, "Dear Dad, you said we wouldn't get foreclosed on, too. How can I trust you?"
Yeah, I can't imagine. You know, I've got an 11-year-old daughter as well. I can't imagine being in that situation.
It's rough. Well, and the worst part about it is I've become an activist. I fight to desperately try to keep this from happening to other people. And so far, I've failed on almost every account. It's continuing to happen to people constantly. And the thing is the program that we were in was called a HAMP program.
Right.
And we went to the White House, a bunch of activists with Home Defenders League and New Bottom Line, and we went to the White House, and about 250 of us, and we begged the White House to start taking the foreclosure fraud seriously, to start really trying to keep people in their homes. And when I walked in the door of this White House conference at the White House, I mean, this is, I'm finally going to get my voice heard. They hand me a pack of papers with the same logo on it that was handed to me when I first got in the program. The last time I saw that logo, that seal, that government seal, my home was stolen from me.
So who's responsible for this? I mean, because, you know, when the housing crisis first began, when 2008, when the bubble burst and we end up in free fall, One of the things that I said should have happened is we should have moved to a program much like they did during the Depression, the Home Ownership Loan Corporation, where we just started buying people's mortgages up. You showed that you could pay, and we refinanced at a lower rate, at a lower at the lower principal. Everybody took a haircut, but the housing market was somewhat stabilized. Who in this scenario is at fault? I mean, is it the administration? Is it how the bank administered it? Or is it, as you've said, just out-and-out fraud that the bank said, you know what, here's a chance for us to steal back this property, resell it, and, oh, by the way, have this guy keep paying me while we do this?
Well, this is, I mean, the fraud is so deep and so intense. It goes way back. I mean, the entire reason there was a bubble in the first place was because of mortgage fraud. And there's been settlements and cases where the banks have had to admit that they were falsely playing with the system, trying to increase prices on homes. I'll tell you what, you know, in America, we don't have, most of us, pensions and retirement plans and everything else. About the last vestige of wealth for the American working man or woman with their home.
Absolutely.
And so, of course, we all had to buy a home. The problem is that all of the prices were inflated falsely, specifically to pad the pockets of the bank. So now instead of a family trying to get into a home at a reasonable price, we're having to get into a home at prices that are almost double what they should be. And in order to make that happen, the banks then come up with all these funny financing programs to let it happen. And then when the homeowner says, how can I possibly afford $200,000? I'm not kidding you. This happened over and over and over again. The broker would tell them, you don't have to worry about that because a few years, 2 years from now, before everything goes crazy, before this gets too expensive, I'm personally going to come back here and refinance this home for you. And the thing is we're talking about working people, people who are working their butts off 40, 50, 60 hours a week. And they're trying to find a way to shelter their family, and they've got a financial expert telling them that, yes, they can afford this home. Well, they're the experts. We trust them.
Yep. And I've heard that story so many times, and I know people who the other part of it is, well, you know, hey, it may be a lot now, but in a couple of years, the amount of it, the value of this property is going to go through the roof, and you'll be, and we bought it. You'll be wealthier, and you can refinance it down the road, and everything will be wonderful. The problem is, you know, that Ponzi scheme, it popped.
Yeah. Well, and it was designed, people knew it was going to pop. That's why they started buying insurance. To protect themselves. I mean, that's how deep the fraud goes. So we had fraudulent mortgages written in the first place, sold with pressure tactics. Then, on top of all that, the banks that were selling these that they knew were bad, they knew would fail, they were doing it so that they could cash in on the insurance. They simply bought insurance that said that, hey, if these things fail, we're going to get paid anyway. Then they sold these things out to investment packages. They sold them into our pension. They sold them to our firefighters and our police and our school teachers, knowing they were going to fail and knowing they were going to collect the insurance on them. So the actual investor got screwed once. Then the servicer collects the insurance. So now the original loans already been paid for by the insurance. The bank essentially are just servicing these loans. They don't own them, but they're owned by the investment packages, by the police department. Our teachers. So, of course, they don't care if they foreclose. They're not losing the money. It's our pensions that are losing the money. And they make more money by filing paperwork to foreclose on people than they make trying to keep people in their homes.
And that's the problem.
And that's the problem. They have zero financial investment. They actually make more money by foreclosing on people. So all of this is what led to the $25 billion settlement. This is why they had to pay all this back in the first place. And now, instead of actually, you know, admitting and taking some responsibility for what they've done to the American people and actually keeping people in their homes, they're spending, about 8%. They're trying to keep people in the home. The rest of them, they're writing down principles so that people can, or sorry, not writing down principles. They're putting people into short sales. So they still lose their home, but they don't lose as much faith. Like, matters.
Yeah.
Like that matters to our home, our communities.
And I go back to what a banker friend of mine said, you know, at the beginning of this. He said, you know, this is all the fault of politicians who rewrote banking laws, who undid Glass-Steagall and allowed boring banks to be gambling casinos. And he said, you could see right about the time the mentality of the banker changed from can you afford the mortgage to how much is the property worth when we take it back and resell it. And that's the problem.
You're absolutely right, Rick. And so you've got the bankers who are responsible for the original crisis. They cost everyone, whether you're in foreclosure trouble or not. It costs everyone. Everyone's losing jobs. Everyone's having trouble getting by. They're responsible for that originally. But at some point, the administration has to assume some responsibility as well. Because I wouldn't have trusted Wells Fargo as long as I did had there not been a government seal on my paperwork implying that they were actually overseeing this and they were going to make sure that I didn't get screwed. That's not what happened. And
that's
unfortunately,
an
it's undermining everything that our American financial system is based on. As a small business owner, I'm an entrepreneur. Most small businesses, they're started on kitchen tables. They're started out of people's homes. And once we start those businesses, we become entrepreneurs. We take that risk because we know that it's a limited risk, that we will succeed or fail based on our own merit, but that if somebody tries to defraud us or screw us, that we will be protected by our laws. So it's a limited risk. Well, unfortunately, that's the biggest fraud of all, is that those laws have been undermined. And since they're undermined, that has undermined the entrepreneurial spirit. How many of us can afford to make the investments that we need to rebuild our economy if we don't even feel safe in our own homes?
That's
if we know that at any minute our greatest financial asset can simply be stolen from us. We've got to fix this problem, the foreclosure problem, the mortgage problem, in order to get our economy back up.
I'm right there with you. Last line of questioning then. You know, how do we do it? What should we be doing? What are you guys at the Home Defenders League advocating for? Where should we begin?
Well, firing DeMarco would be nice. DeMarco is currently sort of overseeing the Fannie Fannie homes, and he is standing in the way of principal write down, which would save a lot of homeowners, would keep them in their homes. The most important, because none of these settlements have teeth enough to be, you know, to actually affect the problem. The most important thing we need to see, in my opinion, is prosecutions. The savings and loan scandal was about 1/70th the size of the scandal, and over 1,000 bankers went to jail. Not a single banker has gone to jail from this crisis, from this fraud. And because no one's gone to jail, they know they can get away with it, and they know they can continue the same practices as usual.
And the sad reality is we've allowed them to grow bigger and more powerful instead of breaking them up as we should have done in 2008.
Exactly. We know that there was a bubble, so now our thought is let's build everything back up to the level of the bubble. No, we've got to write down principal. We've got to start spending money to keep people in their homes. We've got to convince banks to take a little bit less profit. Right now, on a 30-year mortgage, most banks are making 2 to 2.5 times the original investment. If they simply took 1.5 times, millions of families could stay in their homes. We've got to write down principal. We've got to start refinancing at lower rates. You know, Obama, during his State of the Union address, he's touting the new refinance program, which is great. And to put it forward, in the address, he said that too many young families who have never missed a payment are asking to be refinanced or being told no. Well, I've got the message I have for him is that too many families that have never missed a payment are being foreclosed on, are losing their homes. We've got to stop that problem.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think there should be foreclosure moratorium. We should put a stop to this. And I'm, you know, and I don't know where you'll go with this, but I firmly believe we need to take these private for-profit corporations out of this mix and solve this crisis. And then you get, then if you have to, you give it back. But there's got to be someone directly accountable. And I firmly believe you go back to the model of the Home Ownership Loan Corporation during the Roosevelt years. That worked.
I absolutely agree.
Very successful, actually turned a profit, and when it was done, they shut it down and had strong rules in place. We're not even getting the strong rules back. We didn't reinstate Glass-Steagall. We didn't go put that fine line between banking and gambling. That should have been the very first place, and that's where I think this administration has failed in this vein. And I got to tell you, my heart bleeds for you. That's a horrible situation to be in, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck, and I hope you'll keep up the fight for others.
I sure will. I appreciate it. There are millions suffering under the same thing. My story is not at all the most egregious.
Steve, I appreciate the time. Thanks for your story, and thanks
for your fight. I really appreciate it, Rick.
Thanks so much. Steve Bailey, a member of the Home Defenders League. The website, homedefendersleague.org. You can get there from the ricksmithshow.com. Just click on Steve's name. Quick break, right back. Stick around. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Have you had your minimum daily requirement of nanos today? Nanomaterials, that is, manufactured or natural substances that are broken down in high-tech facilities to be teensy-tiny, molecule-sized particles. Don't look for them on the ingredient list of food packages, because the big corporate processors of our edibles don't want us to know that their goodies include these minuscule, mysterious things that, when ingested, go to places in the body that regular foodstuffs don't directly enter, such as straight into your cells. There's been precious little research on the human health impacts of nanos, though studies have shown them having unpleasant effects on mice. Also, our food regulators have flatly and ominously said they don't have enough information even to evaluate the safety of nanomaterials. So why are they popping up in processed foodstuffs? No one is talking, except a few anonymous food manufacturers who express enthusiasm for the ability for the whatever they are to make processed food seen creamier, and to brighten food colors. A watchdog group called As You Sow sent a survey to 2,500 food manufacturers asking about their use of nanos. A whopping 26 responded, only 14 of which claimed not to use the things. The group ran its own test of 10 varieties of powdered donuts, finding that the sweet concoctions of Hostess Brands and Dunkin' Donuts had products containing a nano called titanium dioxide. What benefit does it offer? It makes white substances brighter. This is Jim Hightower saying, hello. An unknown number of corporate food profiteers are pumping an unknown amount of unknown nanomaterials straight into our cells, having an unknown impact on our health, for no better reason than to enhance the cosmetics of their products. To fight the madness, go to asyousow.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at therickSmithShow.com is where you can email me or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the president wants to raise the minimum wage and the right losing their mind. And I got to be honest, I don't know how in this country you can make a living on minimum wage. And even lower than that, you look at what we pay restaurant workers. You look at tipped employees, $2.13 an hour. I can't even tell you when the last time their minimum wage was raised. And I can bet you probably won't be in this time around. But the question then becomes, you know, how is it that those folks who bring your meals to your table, work in those restaurants, how is it that they can eke out existence? Well, my next guest, Saru Jerriman, she wrote a book, Behind the Kitchen Door, examining just that very question. She is also the founder of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. Saru, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I asked the question, you know, how is it that, you know, the waitress who brings me my meal, the cook behind the counter makes, how is it these folks survive on really low wages and even worse, the conditions under which they labor?
Yes. It's just, you know, it's crazy. People live on $2.13 an hour, which ends up not even being a wage because it goes entirely to taxes. So people end up getting a paycheck that says this is not a paycheck.
Yeah.
Which means they live entirely on tips. And how do they make it? How do they live? Well, you know, a large percentage of them actually rely on food stamps. Servers use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce, which means that the people who put food on our tables can't afford to feed themselves or their families. A large percent of them rely on public assistance. Those who are not eligible for public assistance, you know, go in and out often of homelessness. I think it's something people don't know, that restaurant workers experience very high levels of homelessness, meaning not just homelessness, meaning living on the street, although that happens too, but insecurity, inability to pay the rent, eviction, moving from place to place. If anybody's read Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimes, you may remember,
yep. The
only section in which she actually lived in her car was when she was working in a restaurant. And this is literally how people live. They live in their cars, and these are full-time working adults living in extreme poverty, living off of tips, living in extreme instability and insecurity. And it's all due to the political power of the extreme influence of the trade association, the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA. You know, the NRA, the Rifle Association, has been getting a lot of attention, but people don't know there's this equally powerful, equally corrupt influencer on Congress called the National Restaurant Association. That's all the Fortune 500 restaurant companies that struck a deal with Congress back in 1996 to keep the minimum wage for tip workers frozen forever at $2.13.
I mean, it just blows my 1996, the last time they raised it.
No, actually, 1991 was the last time they raised it. 1996, it was about to raise, and it got frozen thanks to our dear friend Herman Cain, who at the time was the head of the Restaurant Association and struck this deal. So it hasn't risen in 22 years.
Yeah, and you look at this and you go, these are the folks who are at the very bottom of the economic ladder, and these are the people who need the help the most. These are the folks who we need to be raising the minimum wage for. I mean, because you look at the conditions that they labor under, and I talk to waitresses quite often. I mean, you talk about the discrimination, you talk about the exploitation, the harassment, all of the other things that they put up with, and you throw on top of that crummy wages and basically, as you're saying, homelessness. Who would want to do it then?
Well, the thing that people don't know is that it's actually the fastest growing sector of our economy. This is where the jobs are for people. This is the sector that's growing while all other sectors of the economy are declining. So you've got the largest and fastest growing of the sector of the economy, over 10 million jobs, expected to add another 2 million jobs in the next couple of years. You've got the largest and fastest growing sector of the economy proliferating, literally, as you said, the lowest paying jobs, 7 of the 11 lowest paying jobs in America, and the 2 absolute lowest paying jobs in America are restaurant worker jobs. And so we're growing our economy on these incredibly poverty level jobs. This is the jobs that people can find. And I want to say something else. People take great pride in hospitality. It's not that they, can't find anything else, or they're moving on to something better. That may be the case in some cases, but there are plenty of restaurant workers who take great pride in hospitality, in cooking and serving, and would like to make a profession out of it, except they're not treated like professionals. They experience, as you said, extremely high levels of sexual harassment, discrimination, inability to move up the ladder, severe health and safety conditions, low wages, and lack of benefits that impact our health as well. 90% of these workers don't have paid sick days, which means that 2/3 cook, prepare, and serve our food when they're sick. In my book, you'll find stories of workers who worked with H1N1 or pink eye or the flu. And it's not the purpose of the book is not to tell people don't eat out. It's to say we really need to know what's happening behind the kitchen door and demand change in this industry.
Yeah, you know, but for me, I go back to I'm a big union supporter. I think the best way to change any condition is to give people power on the job and give them the ability to collectively bargain. And for me, this is an area rife with abuse and exploitation, and a place where we absolutely need that kind of organization, that kind of unity.
Yes, workers should, you know, we, Restaurant Opportunity Center is not a union, but we are a workers' organization that has helped workers stand up when they're being exploited on the job. We've won 13 campaigns against large, high-profile restaurant companies' exploitation and discrimination. We've won $7 million in stolen tips and wages and paid sick days and raises for thousands of workers. We encourage anybody who's a restaurant worker to become a part of the movement, who's listening, to become a part of the movement, to join us in demanding change in this industry. We've won quite a bit of policy changes as well, and as you mentioned, now we have the chance to actually raise the minimum wage for tipped workers and for all workers once and for all. And the primary blocking force is the National Restaurant Association. We need to collectivize our voices as restaurant workers to counterbalance the voice and power of the National Restaurant Association. But I will say we also need people who eat out, everybody who eats out, consumers, to stand by our side, which is why we've written the book, which is why we're mobilizing everybody who eats out, asking you to join a new consumer organization we've created called The Welcome Table, which can be found at www.thewelcometable.net. Join this consumer organization online to stand by the workers who are standing up for themselves.
And what is that organization? What are you going to help me find places that are treating their employees well? What's the basis for it?
Yes, that's right. We've created something called the Rock National Diners Guide and smartphone app that you can download it for free on your smartphone, and you can find out how the restaurants around you are faring on wages, benefits, and promotions practices. And we'd like you to use it not to decide where to eat out every night, and we'd like you to support the restaurants that get an award in the guide for doing the right thing. But we're not asking people to not eat out everywhere else, because literally it's everywhere else. The industry is too large, and unfortunately the low wages and poor conditions are too pervasive for us to say don't eat out at places that pay $2.13, because literally that's 90% of the industry. So instead, we're asking you to speak up every time you eat out. The smartphone app has tweets you can send to management every time you eat out, or you can do it the old-fashioned way at the end of your meal, say to the manager, love the food, love the service, would love to see you provide paid sick days so that I can keep coming here as a customer, or I would love to see you pay more than $2.13 because that's important to me as a customer. We feel that when customers ask these questions in the past around, you know, things like, is this locally sourced? Are these organic produce? You know, that really created change in the industry. The industry responded by creating locally sourced organic menu items. We feel like if we now ask every time we eat out about 6 days of minimum wage, we might be able to see the same kind of change. And joining together, collectivizing our voices through the welcome table, we can actually have political power as well. We can say there are 1 million consumers in America who demand to see an increase to the minimum wage, who demand to see paid sick days. It's the only way we can let Congress know that they actually shouldn't be listening to the moneyed lobbies. They should be listening to people who eat out and the people who work in restaurants.
I'm right there with you. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Saru Jayaraman. She's written the book Behind the Kitchen Door. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com where you can pick it up. Just click on Saru's name. It'll take you right there. You know, we go to some of these, you know, chain restaurants, and we go to locally owned restaurants, too. Is there any difference? I mean, are some better than the others? I mean, are the big chains, do they treat their employees? Because every time you go to them, they're always very professional, very, you know, I can't imagine me in that situation working for pennies or and being very happy about it. But you know, the folks that I come across, you know, they're wonderful. They do a great job, and I make sure that I tip them well. But yeah, I can't imagine. Which is better, do you think, or is there a difference?
Well, unfortunately, we see exploitative working conditions, low wages, poor benefits in all kinds of restaurants, in all kinds of segments and ownership structures. But I will say that the National Restaurant Association is largely led by the large restaurant corporations like Darden, which owns Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse. It's the world's largest full-service restaurant company and one that probably most of your listeners have not heard of. They are leading the effort to keep the minimum wage at $2.13 and prevent paid sick days from happening. Companies like that, Applebee's, McDonald's, Taco Bell, Outback Steakhouse, which is a Bain company, these companies are leading the effort to keep the minimum wage low and to prevent paid sick days. So although you'll find these kinds of conditions across the board, it is important to know which companies are actually creating the law through their corporate lobbying efforts. It's important to note that in eating out and to speak up when you eat at those restaurants and say, I don't approve of paying workers at 2:13 or not providing paid sick days. I'd like to see you not only change your practices, but stop lobbying the government to keep things the way they are. This is not healthy for any of us. So it's important to note that there are local restaurants, mom-and-pop restaurants, that are doing the right thing, and there are a few chains that are doing the right thing. There's a company called In-N-Out Burger in California that's a great employer. So it's not the case that one type of employer or another has to be evil or bad or good. It's that anybody and everybody could do better, could do the right thing by their employees. And we have examples across the board. We have great employers who've gotten awards in the guide across the board. Who show that it can be done.
Last question I've got for you. You know, when I leave my tip, I often wonder, is this something that the waiter or the waitress is ever going to get? Is this something that the boss is going to keep? Which is better, putting a credit card on the credit card, putting it in cash? Quick answer to that.
Yeah, we believe it's better to tip in cash, because unfortunately, too often employers may take a piece of the tip. Also, in every locality except Philadelphia, where we passed a law making it illegal, employers can deduct credit card processing fees from workers' tips.
Oh, you're kidding
which
me.
Which is unfortunate. Yeah, in Philly, we passed a law making that illegal, and the restaurants, you know, were up in arms about it. But everywhere else, employers deduct credit card processing fees from workers' tips, which is why we recommend leaving it in cash. We definitely recommend tipping well, because these employees are living on these tips as their wages. But tipping well is not enough. We need everybody to say, actually, this industry should not be subsidized by our tips. They should pay their own work wages, and then we can tip on top of that.
I'm right there with you. Saru, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Saru Jayaraman, she's written the book Behind the Kitchen Door. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. You can get there from our website. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Mr. Heffendig and Mr. Harley can haul it, because I'm going to leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul, and Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short day for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig and Mr. Harley can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Earth, sky.
In late 2012, researchers at the National Marine Mammal Foundation published their acoustic analysis of the voice of a whale that apparently can imitate a human voice. Here's what he sounds like from an audio track made by scientist Sam Ridgway and his team, courtesy of the journal Current Biology.
That sound is coming from a beluga, or white whale, named Nock. He lived in an enclosure at the National Marine Mammal Foundation, among dolphins and other white whales. He'd often been in the presence of humans. Researchers working near him sometimes thought they heard another person talking. They were surprised to find the voice was coming from the whale.
That was in 1984. Prior to that time, there had been anecdotal reports of whales sounding like humans, but no real evidence or analysis. Scientists at the National Marine Mammal Foundation recorded the whale's sounds. They found a rhythm similar to human speech and fundamental frequencies several octaves lower than typical whale sounds.
They said the observations suggest it wasn't easy for the whale to make these sounds. And that, they said, suggests motivation for contact on the part of the whale. For more about Nock, the whale with a human voice, come to EarthSky.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org. Earth.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? Time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Isn't it? Less wages, less health care, less benefits, less safety, less voice, less, less for you, more for them. I mean, I don't know how much simpler it can get. And you look at the fact, I thought it was 96, the tipped wage went up to 213. 1991. I mean, think about that for a second. 1990, 21 years ago. So the woman who served me my lunch today wasn't a year old or a couple years old when the last time the wage that she's working for now was put into place. It's mind-blowing to me. And, you know, she's right. I mean, the reality is these are the jobs. This is what's here. These, and I go back to the Reagan era. Because this is the Reagan vision. Understand that. And I know that the right loves to, you know, to make sure that we believe the sainted Ron was, you know, this great leader who, you know, he was going to lead us to trickle down, everything was going to be wonderful. But most of the things that have happened, it's that ideology that he pushed. And he wasn't the only one. This, again, goes back to the 50s, back to the 40s and 50s, when the wealth class of this country said, oh, we've paid our penance. Sure, we screwed the economy up. Sure, we caused the depression. Sure, you know, all of you people are suffering, but we're done. We're done paying our penance. And they began assaulting all of those social programs, all of those laws aimed at making sure the rest of us, that we don't live in poverty. And what really is very interesting to me is you go back to the Reagan era, when this really the inequality hit hyperspeed, where we started really moving apart from each other, where the ones who could come up with the schemes to consolidate and steal pensions and do all of that and massively over-leverage these corporations and cut them off to die through bankruptcy, you know, the Romneys of the world, that entrepreneur, they love to say, the thieves, criminals, in my view. You know, I look at this and they go, oh, you know, these private equity people, they create jobs. No. Let's set that record straight. They have a track record of doing a whole lot of damage and have had some successes that I firmly believe would have happened without them. And in fact, without them, I think the entrepreneurial spirit of this country grows exponentially. For you and me, for the folks at the bottom, the people who, you know, like our earlier guest said, start their business at their kitchen table. But you look at this, and this, what really is quite amazing to me, is that we put up with it. I mean, we put up with the crummy wages, we put up with the stagnant, declining wages, we put up with the destruction of benefits, we with the destruction of our education system. We put up with them taking away defined benefits. And, oh, here's this wonderful 401k. In fact, I was talking a little bit today with someone. We were talking about the defined benefit plan because Pennsylvania's, you know, our governor's moving towards this idea that, well, you know, we do away with that defined benefit and give them a defined contribution plan because, you know, that's what private industry did. And it is. It is what the private sector was able to do. The part that the Corbettites and the Republicans in state governments across the state aren't going to tell you is, yeah, private industry moved from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. Absolutely. But the defined benefit plan, they ran through bankruptcies. They saddled on the backs of the taxpayers through the PBGC. They over-leveraged their companies and stole a good portion of it. No, it wasn't stealing. It was legal, as long as they did it the right way with their little loophole. And yet we stand for it. And that's what's infuriating me. So when a state representative says, well, you know, the private sector decided to define contributions the best way to go, you know, why shouldn't we? Well, they decided that because it was the cheapest one. And I go back and I ask the question, you know, what kind of a society do we want to have? You know, you look at that period after World War II, after the Depression, through World War II, where working people were going, I'm sacrificing enough. We need to have a better tomorrow for our kids. And really, I think the wealth class in this country has done a masterful job of convincing you and me and working people that, well, you know, we have to roll up our sleeves and we have to suffer. We got to sacrifice because we've got it too good. And those people who have pensions, they've got it too good. And those union people, they've got it too good. You know, we've got to do what big business wants. Well, let me let you in on a secret. It's never enough. No matter how much you give, no matter how much you struggle, no matter how much you're willing to sacrifice, it's never going to be enough. You know that. And I've been saying for a while what this country, what the working people of this country suffer from is a form of Stockholm Syndrome. We have been beaten over the head for so long, we have been screwed for so long, that we're just going, well, you know, at least I got a job. Instead of saying, you know, $2.13 an hour, can you imagine that? 21 years without a raise. Oh, I know, they're tipped employees. And I think Saru has it right. They should be able to make a living wage. And if they do a good job, you tip them on top of that. Instead of saying, well, you know, this is how you're going to make your living. And if no customers come through the door, you don't exist. You're homeless. Because I often wonder, you know, you look at a lot of these folks who, you know, they're struggling. And look, I love the way the right marginalizes this stuff, especially when you talk about minimum wage at all. Well, they're just high school kids learning a craft. And if you raise that minimum wage, they won't get the opportunity. They won't. They won't be able to have that first job. When we know the reality is, we know the good majority of minimum wage workers are 20 and older. And a good majority of them, more than half, work full time. Many of them are married. Many of them have children. It's how they raise their families. It's not a bunch of high school kids, you know, working on the weekends and have movie money. No, these are families. It may have been that way at one point. Yeah, I took my kids back to Cleveland with me for a business trip. And we went through and, you know, I said, you know, this is where we used to live. And, you know, I had a paper route. You know, these are the two streets I used to have. I had 300 Sundays. Kids don't do paper routes anymore. Why? Mom and Dad are doing it. The jobs that I used to do as a kid for a little extra money and to learn, how to be money smart, how to go out and hustle and make a buck, those jobs are taken up by parents. My kids aren't going to be able to have a paper route. My kids aren't going to be out there cutting grass. I got landscaping companies who do that. All of those things that I learned as a kid, I'm not that old. That's how people are supporting their families now. Because the wages keep falling. The wages keep falling. The benefits are going away. And yet we've got business friendly running our government. Something seriously wrong. And we need to be taking things back. That's why March 2nd here in Harrisburg, Keystone Progress is going to be holding their Pennsylvania Progressive Summit 2013, Fighting Back, Moving Forward, the theme. You can go to paprogressivesummit.org. We'll make sure we get a link at therickspinosashow.com. Their keynote speaker is going to be David Cobb. He's the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. Making sure that, you know, corporations are not people. Only people are people. Quick break, back with hour three. Stick around. You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
What could end up being one of President Barack Obama's biggest decisions this year has the progressive movement divided. At some point this spring, it's expected that the president will finally give a thumbs up or thumbs down to the Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline transports synthetic crude oil from the oil sands region of Alberta, Canada, to refineries in the United States. The XL pipeline is intended to expand on that distribution.
Obama has opposed building the pipeline near the Sand Hills region of Nebraska due to the potential environmental impact. But in March of 2012, he endorsed the building of the second part near Cushing, Oklahoma. Organized labor has been mostly on board with building the pipeline, with the primary concern being how and where it's built. Last year, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka told C-SPAN that he believed labor was mostly unanimous in the effort to build the pipeline.
I think we're all unanimous by saying we should build the pipeline, but we have to do it consistent with all environmental standards. And I think we can work that out. I really do. And we are for that happening.
Last week, AFL-CIO Building and Construction Trades Department President Sean McGarvey joined in on a conference call hosted by the American Petroleum Institute to reiterate support by the AFL, especially now that the pipeline's trajectory has been shifted in Nebraska. McGarvey stressed that the pipeline would provide much-needed jobs in the construction industry. Even as labor expresses support for the pipeline, thousands of progressives have stressed that there are a myriad of other reasons to oppose the pipeline's expansion. WIN's Melinda Tuhus attended the Forward on Climate rally in Washington, D.C. on Sunday.
Van Jones took the stage near the start of the rally. He worked in Obama's White House on green jobs and now works with Rebuild the Dream.
President Obama, all the good that you have done, all the good you can imagine doing, will be wiped out by floods, by fires, by superstorms, if you fail to act now to deal with this crisis that is a gun pointed at the head of the future.
Two Native women from Canada spoke about the environmental and public health damage that's already been wreaked on their Indigenous lands and peoples by TransCanada's process of extracting the tar sands. They're trying to stop another pipeline through British Columbia for exporting tar sands to Asia. Grace Horvath is a high school junior from Virginia who attends a science and math academy. She said when she heard about the rally, she did some research on the Keystone XL pipeline.
It doesn't benefit us directly except maybe creating jobs, but I don't see why those jobs aren't being created with wind and solar energy.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program anywhere you go. It's there for your convenience, your entertainment, your enjoyment. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on the mind, give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Again, the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit 2013, Fighting Back, Moving Forward. March 1st and 2nd here in Harrisburg at the Harrisburg Hilton. As I said, the keynote speaker is going to be a guy named David Cobb, the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. And you amended saying, sorry, corporations, not people. Also going to have the three Democratic row officers. Attorney General Kathleen Kane will be there. Auditor General Eugene DePasquale will be there. And also Treasurer Rob McCord. But some national figures as well. Congressman Raul Grijalva from Arizona will be there. Jim Dean, Chair of Democracy for America, and a whole host of other folks. A bunch of workshops, an excellent opportunity to learn, an excellent opportunity to network, and just to, you know, be part of the community that I believe we need to grow, build, because if we're going to change this country, if we're going to get headed in the right direction, so people like Steve Bailey, the guy we talked to in the last hour, doesn't get his home stolen from him, so that workers who work in restaurants and low-wage workers get health care and a reasonable wage, this is the way forward. I hope to see you there. We'll have a table set up. I'm going to be doing some interviews and talking to folks. You know, it's all about the organizing. It's all about getting the word out. But, you know, I look at this, and I was thinking about during the break, when we talk with Steve Bailey, which that's an interview I think everybody has to hear. And look, you got to go back, and if you didn't hear it, get the podcast, listen to it, because that could happen to any one of us. I listened to his story, and man, you know, it could have been me. You know, had I fallen on hard times, had, you know, for a month I had fallen behind, you know, caught up, fallen behind again, and oh, the bank calls and says, hey, you know, I see you're having a little problem. You've been a good customer. We're gonna help you go through a modification program. And we're gonna redo this, reduce your rate, reduce your payment for, you know, we'll be fine. We'll work through this together. We're your bank. And then you get down the road, 7 months, 8, 9 months down the road, and you're in the street. After you've told your daughter that, you know what, we're not gonna lose our home. Trust me. Man, I cannot imagine that. I mean, because, you know, I think about myself with my kids, and it breaks my heart to think about, you know, a father having to go to their daughter and say, you know, hey, I didn't think we were going to lose our home, but we did. I can't even imagine that conversation going home from that court hearing and telling, looking into those eyes and saying, you know, I was wrong. We have to move. We have to leave the home that we love. We have to leave our friends. We have to go. And there's nothing we can do about it. Because we thought we were doing the right thing. We did what we were told, and we got screwed anyway. And you know, the thing is that story is replicated over and over and over again. It's not an isolated incident. If you've been listening to this program, you've heard other stories just like it. Which is what's infuriating to me. There should absolutely be a moratorium. And as I said from the beginning, and I go back to my original gut feeling on this, my gut feeling on it was pretty simple. The profiteers got us into this mess. They did. They figured out schemes and scams and angles and you name it, they figured it out. Why would we put them back in charge of undoing the mess that they created and then be surprised when what they are doing isn't helping? And it's actually screwing us even worse. You know, I saw a story the other day about, you know, these zombie mortgages is what they were calling them. And, you know, I've known a couple of people who've, you know, they overpaid. They went through they overpaid for their mortgage through the roof. And they said, look, you know, I can't afford it. Lost my job. Lost the health care, whatever. Someone got sick. And they just walked away from the house. Well, what they find out now is, you know, after they've walked away from the house, they found out, well, gee, guess what? I still owe it. They're not paying taxes. They're not paying the association fees. The sheriff kicked me out of the house. Bank threw me out down the door. But they never moved on foreclosing the house. I mean, you stop and you look at the schemes these people have gotten away with. And there's nobody in jail yet? I guess there probably is never going to be. Let's go to the phone line. It's got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Great, Rick. How about yourself?
I'm good, you know, but I got to tell you, the guy I talked to earlier, it just breaks my heart.
Yeah, it does me too. Did they get rid of that guy DeMarco yet, like
nope.
You said?
No, it hasn't happened yet.
Oh, gosh. He's been like the main stumbling block of getting, you know, a program set up that actually works for people that own the homes.
But you know, the more I'm
lowering the principal.
Yeah, well, that's
totally against the cram down, and that's the whole thing with our system. There used to be a system where judges, you know, bankruptcy judges, could cram down the mortgages,
yep,
the principal, and that went away. You know, like in the, I think during Reagan's time, there was a judgment that stopped the cram downs. And that's all they have to do is bring the cram down back.
And I said that, you know, right when everything happened, I said, look, what I wanted to see is, you know, the Home Ownership Loan Corporation revive that, bring that back, and say, look, we, the government, we're going to buy up all of these underwater mortgages. We're going to reduce the principal, lower rates, so we stop the foreclosure. We stop this free fall, and we give some stability to the market. But
right.
What we've decided is, no, the people who got us into this mess, well, we're going to take care of them.
Right. What you do is you recapitalize the banks, make them whole, make them solid, and then you let the weaker people, the people that actually own the homes, the purchaser, the mortgage owners, you know, cast them out to sea, you know, without a lifeline.
But, you know,
without
a life preserver. Yeah, and talking to that Steve Bailey, one of the things that didn't click with me until he said it was, you know, the thing is, you know, these private corporations are getting away with this stuff with the federal government logo right on it. And,
right.
And to me, you know, you go, you know, this is break out that mission accomplished banner that Bush used, because this is the right wing dream. See, government can't work. They got the seal right on it, even though it was the profiteers who effed it up.
Right. We the people goes out the window, and it's total capture of the agencies, you know, with the corporations. You know, that's the definition of a fascist state, of course, when you have this regulatory capture like that. You know, they're not working for we the people. They're working for the corporations,
yep.
The servicers, and the mortgage companies. That's it's so criminal.
And, you know, I read this story the other day. They were talking about these zombie mortgages where, you know, that you're foreclosed on. They kick you out of your house. And, well, they never really finished the process. So the taxes are still in your name, the association fees, whatever, you know, whatever, the trash pick, whatever. All of these bills, they're just piling on your credit and unpaid for years because you didn't know about it because you thought, hey, they foreclosed on me. It's not my house anymore. But here we're finding out a lot of these people stuck with these massive tax bills.
Right, and it's so hard when you're an individual to get the legal help and to arrange that, and such a hassle, you know, when you're working and you got kids and you have that hassle hanging over you, you know, they go to the mat with you to get out there. It's a shame. XL Pipeline, Rick, I'm on the other side of the fence on that one, man.
I'll be honest with you. I'm not in favor of the pipeline. If they built it to Chicago and said that we'll only use the oil here, then maybe you could make an argument for it, but I just don't see that how it's going to benefit us other than creating jobs. And you know, as the wind clip said, you know, we could put people into building solar and wind power.
Absolutely. Yeah, at least that would be, you could make a case for it, but you know where that's going to go. It's going to go overseas. It's just going to go right through this country to the world markets.
Yep. And which is what they want to do with natural gas as well. I mean, you know, we've talked about this before. It's all about the international. It's about these big multinationals. It has nothing to do with you or me. I mean, we've never drilled as much as we're drilling right now. And what's
right.
Gas? $3.80 a gallon?
Right. And Obama's got a tough decision because the trade deficit actually benefits immensely from the petroleum exports. You know, it was still bad, $540.8 billion or something like that. Trade, they expected, and using, as I said, $775 billion or $750 billion is what was anticipated for 2012. But because of petroleum exports and the lack of importing oil, the trade deficit wasn't as bad. And the import-export differential has a direct effect on GDP. And Obama's got to be weighing that in his decision, unfortunately.
But, you know, at the end of it, I think it's going to get built. I think it's going to happen because the wealth wants it.
Game over.
And we, as we know, in this country, wealth gets what wealth wants.
Can't deny that unless something happens, something big, you know, people really start to turn the screws like the French people managed to do.
Well, I mean, you see what's going on over there?
Get everybody out of the street, just shut it down.
Yeah, well, you see what's going on over there now? You got this.
when they got on Maurice's case, man, they let him have it.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of it, you know, I saw this story, and I think you sent it to me as well, about the CEO of Titan Tires, Titan International, the tire company, saying, well, they're lazy and they don't want to work and they have all these rules and these so-called workers. And you go, you know, that's a typical arrogant, you know, narcissistic, egomaniacal American CEO who, you know, we let him get away with it here.
Right. Couldn't agree with you more, man. Guys, just takes a shot at the worker, saying that for 4 hours a day, they're basically laying around doing nothing. From what I found, the Europeans, when they're working hard. And when they get off, they play hard.
Yeah.
You know, with the time they're at work, though, they're pushing it.
Yeah, but, you know, what interested me is in the article is, you know, the CEO says, well, what we'll do is we'll make the tires in China and in India, and we'll bring them back here, and we'll crush your other tire company. And to me, that's exactly what's wrong with what we're doing in this country. We're allowing
right.
these CEOs to hold us hostage and to pit us against other low-wage world workers. And at some
that's
point...
That's the free trade deals you talk about all the time.
At some point, we got to stop it.
It's got to be... Absolutely. Absolutely. It's wrong. we have to have tariffs. We have to go back to the Hamilton plan. It's what made this country great. Everybody else is doing it. If you can offshore that work to China. Did you see, too, where Foxconn, the duration of a Foxconn worker is like 13 months, the average of a Chinese Foxconn worker, the guys who make the Apples and the HPs and Dells and stuff.
Well, that's not bad.
13 months.
That's not bad. You know what the average you know what the average of a poultry worker
turnover.
With the poultry worker in the South is? About 6 months.
Wow.
I mean, we love to point to the Chinese and the exploitation that goes on over there. And there is. We got it right here at home.
Right. Ah, just a shame.
Well, it's going to take you and
the case for the unionization, man.
Yep, it's going to take you and me saying enough is enough, and there's only so much of you know what we're willing to eat, and to the streets we go, marching, marching, marching.
Right, right.
Anyway,
we got to get together. We got to work together. As
absolutely,
a team, man.
Absolutely.
All right, take care of yourself.
Always great talking with you, Andy. Appreciate it.
Hope your family's doing well. Bye bye.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Have you had your minimum daily requirement of nanos today? Nanomaterials, that is, manufactured or natural substances that are broken down in high-tech facilities to be teensy-tiny, molecule-sized particles. Don't look for them on the ingredient list of food packages, because the big corporate processors of our edibles don't want us to know that their goodies include these minuscule, mysterious things that, when ingested, go to places in the body that regular foodstuffs don't directly enter, such as straight into your cells. There's been precious little research on the human health impacts of nanos, though studies have shown them having unpleasant effects on mice. Also, our food regulators have flatly and ominously said they don't have enough information even to evaluate the safety of nanomaterials. So why are they popping up in processed foodstuffs? No one is talking, except a few anonymous food manufacturers who express enthusiasm for the ability for the whatever they are to make processed foods seem creamier and to brighten food colors. A watchdog group called As You Sow sent a survey to 2,500 food manufacturers asking about their use of nanos. A whopping 26 responded, only 14 of which claimed not to use the things. The group ran its own test of 10 varieties of powdered donuts, finding that the sweet concoctions of Hostess brands and Dunkin' Donuts had products containing a nano called titanium dioxide. What benefit does it offer? It makes white substances brighter. This is Jim Hightower saying, hello. An unknown number of corporate food profiteers are pumping an unknown amount of unknown nanomaterials straight into our cells, having an unknown impact on our health, for no better reason than to enhance the cosmetics of their products. To fight the madness, go to asyousow.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. So a little bit earlier when we talked with State Senator Judy Schwenk, she said, you know, government leading the race to the bottom. I mean, that was the one quotable moment there. You know, she said, look, you know, we're We've got people running government who want us leading that race to the bottom of the barrel. If it's not wages, it's health care. If it's not health care, it's pensions. If it's not that, it's our infrastructure. It's just this failure on so many levels to have any rational thought of how we have a better tomorrow for you, me, my kids, your kids. And I look at this budget process. Now, I look at the last two budgets this governor has proposed, just absolutely devastating to families, devastating to our state, and this one's not much better. Last couple of days, they've been holding hearings over at the Capitol, and our crack correspondent, Jake Long, has been following them. Jake, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you for that. Those kind words, Rick. The check's in the mail. But seriously...
No, it's actually not.
When you talk about the state police, and I was over there at the House meetings, and I'm also going to cover a little bit about Kathy and Kane and her interview. Both these entities, as you said, are facing some very extreme economic problems, and I'll quickly try to go over some of their testimony to give you an idea. Colonel Newman, who's the head of the state police, he did a very good job enumerating the problems and really painting an accurate picture of exactly what's going on. Something we don't think about, the state police, the aviation units, right now, most of them are about 25 years old. The fleet is aging, and they have some real concerns about how much longer they'll be able to use those units. Marcellus Shale, we have talked about that issue through another perspective, but the fact that in Marcellus Shale, because of crime, and because of additional monitoring that it takes, they've had to shift some of their personnel out there. They've increased their personnel out around Montoursville by about 10%. And again, who pays for that? You and I pay for that because of the increased crime surrounding the Marcellus Shale area. State police cover about two-thirds of the state. And the problem is, Rick, that area that they cover is ever increasing. Why? Because you have more and more communities that just can't afford municipal police forces anymore. So they put that responsibility on the state police, and that is ever increasing. He did say, Colonel Newman did say that right now he would be in favor of the state police being able to give a fee to these municipalities who use state police. Also, the Adam Walchak Act, if you know what that is. That's the act that requires restrictions on sexual predators. A website has established for the public. I mean, that's a positive thing, but again, it costs money. And that's, even though that's vital to the community to protect our children, it costs more money. Mental health records held by the state police are now shared with the federal system on background checks. The state police are getting right now about 3,200 requests a month for background checks when people try to purchase guns, mostly handguns. 3,200 a month, they said they have a total of about an amazing total of 600,000 right now.
Wow.
And to that responsibility, there's a proposal in the line item of an 18% cut, and that might affect that program, affect the program that is vital to some kind of control over to who purchases guns. That could be a serious threat to our state and our society.
What we do with it is we privatize all of it. Give it to the free market. Let them take care of it. You know, because the free market would be really concerned about children, and the free market's really concerned about, you know, people getting guns. So, you know, free market.
Well, here's another issue with guns. This goes right to the heart of what we're having right now as a national discussion. He asked, would you be in favor of arming teachers? He said basically no. He said he would prefer, which I think does make sense, a retired law enforcement individual. I said that does make sense. And he said, in his opinion, the mental health component is the key to increased school safety. Now, I know there's a lot of us that believe that we need to go farther than that, but those are his ideas on the subject. We have seven forensic labs across the state. 70% of the work comes from municipality. We got to have adequate DNA. We cannot ask municipalities to pay for the work because they don't have the money. And if they don't, they don't have the money and they're not going to pay for the work, it's going to be a lot of crimes that aren't going to be solved. And that's a real threat. That's a real threat to the citizens of this state. Station closing. It might occur right now. They're hovering at about a level of 600 below their normal complement. 600. Now, if that level keeps going down, and according to Colonel Noonan, if it gets to about 650, they're going to have to close stations. Now, you have an increased crime. You have more and more municipalities that don't have local police forces. And now you're going to close some of the police protection in some of these areas, and some of these people might have to wait an hour and a half to get a policeman there. You know, that's a horrendous situation. But we're facing that, again, lack of money.
Well, it's not a lack of money. I don't think it's not a lack of money, because there's money there. It's a lack of the priority to put money towards it. Because I truly believe that this is a part of the plan so that they say, see, the police can't get there. An hour to get there, everyone needs a gun. It's all part of that whole lobby in my thought. I'm curious, was any of that brought up?
No, they remain on a professional level. I'm sure some of the people who asked the questions, that might have been in the back of their mind. They didn't get deeply into the gun issue. They didn't get into, you know, what their thoughts were. But I'm sure some of the people on that committee had the same thoughts that you had. Well, here's another issue: wine and spirits. We haven't talked a lot about that. They were asked about the cost of that, and he said if it passes, that's a big if. If it passes, then there's 1,200 privatized wine and liquor stores or outlets. It would cost an additional $5 million. Now, he also said, you know, if that number, and who knows at this point whether it'll be 1,200 or who knows, if that number goes up exponentially, the cost is going to go up. We, you know, Corbett hasn't even talked about that cost. And that cost is going to be added on to the cost of privatizing the wine and spirits.
Oh, stop. No, we're going to save money. It's going to benefit us. It's good for us.
Mm-hmm.
All that other stuff, no, don't look behind the curtain.
Right. And here was another gun question. There seemed to be a lot of gun questions. He was asked if straw purchases would be positively affected by a one-gun-a-month policy, and his answer was he would like to see standardized gun laws for all the states.
Yeah.
That's a good political
answer.
That's a typical answer, but at the end of the day, as I covered a bunch of these issues, these are serious issues. You know, again, you're right. The money is there, but it's the priorities of this administration. They seem to be more concerned about protecting the welfare of the corporations. Attorney General Kathleen Kane, I got to tell you, Rick, she has, if there's a superstar up there in the Capitol, she is it. I mean, all the people who interviewed her were complimentary. I think, honestly, what she did with that PMA agreement and stopping the Corbett administration, I think most of the Republicans and Democrats really appreciated that, because I got a real vibe from those people that they resented what the Corbett administration tried to do on
that
private position.
She did the right thing. She did the right thing.
Yeah, she did.
I mean, I would hope any reasonable, thoughtful public servant would have done the exact same thing. I'm not taking anything away from her. But, you know, the fact is that there's a lawsuit in place that if you were allowed to go forward and the lawsuit went the other way, how much would it cost the taxpayers to untangle, to detangle, and how much would it cost us down the road? She did the absolute right thing, but I would hope any reasonable person would have done that.
Yes, and she enumerated and I'm sure other people have talked about it. She talked about Keno actually wasn't an authorized game under the lottery. That actually should come under the control board. She also talked about the issue of remuneration, money promised to the company, which really doesn't sit into the guidelines set up by the state government. And she also talked about the fact that it infringed on the management of the lottery by the legislature. So she was articulate. She knew her issues. I understand, Rick, and maybe you can update me on it. I was told today that the British company has now taken their money out of the state. Is that true?
That's what I've heard.
Well, that I you know, if I were Corbett, I wouldn't, you know, that doesn't bode well. I hope this is the end of it. I happen to think it isn't. I think he's going to come back. If he can with another offer, but we shall see. I mean, he's bound and determined to privatize the wine and liquor stores. and I hope he falls flat in his face, but I think one-term Tommy will be back on that issue. Anyway, we talk about cuts. She got into some of the cuts. I mean, some of them are pretty Gregorian. She's lost 20 positions in the consumer protection part of her office. She's handled, just to give you an idea of how that impacts the state of Pennsylvania, because of the loss of 20 positions in consumer protection, she has 12,000 fewer cases that she handled. She's cut employees since 2005. Her department has gone from 825 to 335. That affects the ability to investigate medical fraud. She did say, as a general principle, she favors saving money by the state by working with other states in multi-state lawsuits to save money. She talked about, and I'm sure you're aware of this lawsuit, the Standard & Poor's lawsuit. She mentioned that as one of her accomplishments. So I think she's trying to maximize the money that she's getting. However, again, the priorities have to be there for her office. Yeah. Just let me throw you a couple other little ditties here. She has been able to reimburse the county about $75,000 for the DA cost that covered her expenses in the DA office up to 2011. Pike County is presently suing for reimbursement, which I wasn't aware of. They currently face in her department, again, the loss of 57 personnel. They face a $7.8 million shortfall. The PMA description fits into the PMA description. It fits into the gaming description. And as she said before, that's one of the reasons why she decided to pull the plug on that endeavor by the court administration. 17% cut over 5 years for the AG. That affects child predators. She talked about, and this I wasn't aware of, I don't know if you're aware of this, she talked about the Mexican drug cartels. And according to her, they are a real threat. The Attorney General's Association of the United States has given her a heads up on that. They are moving from the western states to the state of Pennsylvania. They, along with local gangs in the big cities, are a real threat to Pennsylvania. The Mexican cartels are coming up I-95 corridor. They are a real, real threat. And according to her, they're replacing what previously was basically drugs from the Colombian drug cartels. The Mexican drug cartel, according to her, are very, very violent and very much more prone to killing people. Right. So there's a real threat in this state, and it's growing. And when you look at the cuts that she faces, every citizen of this state should be really concerned.
Again, comes back down to priorities. And as this budget winds its way down the road, we will have you back and talk more about the budget process. I appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks, Rick. And don't forget that check.
Yeah, I'm on it.
All right.
Take a deep breath and hold.
I will wait patiently by the phone.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
This Valentine's Day, give your special someone a beautiful Swarovski crystal heart made by women who have survived war in South Sudan. These stunning items are available in small, medium, and large sizes and come in crystal, red, pink, and other beautiful colors. And the best part? They're yours starting at just $25 plus shipping. To order yours today, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com and click on shop.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I got no shame.
Smith Show. Got an email during the break asking about the Postal Service. Yesterday we talked about the Postal Service. They evidently have given the okay to this Ohio-based clothing company to make this new line of apparel, rain, heat, and snow. Asked why don't they just sell, why did they have to go to this company? Why don't they just sell what they give their employees? And part of me goes, well, because nobody really wants that. They want fashion. And I don't know that, you know, that's all that good. I'll tell you where you're not going to be able to buy the new rain, heat, and snow fashion attire with the Postal Service logos. The post office. And for me, that should be it should be an exclusive to the post office. But the sad thing is, this is how we're trying to fix the problems created by our friends in the GOP. The poison pill that they put into the law back in 2006 that is going to take the Postal Service. That is fact. But yeah, get your apparel soon before they go out of business. Let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, what do you think? Postal wear? Postal lingerie?
I don't know what to think of that one. That's pretty amazing.
Postal lingerie? What do you think? Call them Saturday deliveries or something like that?
Yeah, I think we should call it Saturday deliveries, right?
Well, since they're evidently after August, not going to be any more Saturday delivering, so might as well. It kind of reminds me, my mother worked in a nursing home for years when I was a little kid, and one of the guys that I would talk to after school said he was one of 19 kids. And I said, you know, wow, you were one of 19 kids? Why? And he looked at me, and I didn't get it until years later. He said, well, we didn't have TV.
Ha!
It was years
That's
later.
Hilarious.
It was years later.
But you know, saying I actually remember getting very excited when you would see the postal truck.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is the thing that really annoys me is the Postal Service is profitable. They are a good for the common good. It's something that is constitutionally mandated, something we should have, something that has been vital to our economic growth. And yet this one poison pill, this one sneaky backdoor piece of
work. Oh, you mean the requirement that they have to pay up ahead of time?
75 years, not just ahead of time, 75
right.
years, and they have to do it in the next 10. I mean, that's what just blows my mind. I mean,
it's so crazy. No business in the world has to do that.
And I don't know how you can with a straight face say, well, you know, they're failing because they're not innovating. No, they're failing because you've saddled them with insane requirements. And not only that, but you've stolen all of the products that they've invented throughout the years and given them away to private industry. You look at FedEx. FedEx was cut out of whole cloth. Why? Because they stole it from the post office.
Well, that's right. Actually, when FedEx designed their business plan, they modeled it after the post office, of course.
Yep. And, well, that's the model we're going to get as we move forward. But just my little rant about the Postal Service. But, hey, get your postal lingerie. I can't wait. Cannot wait to see it. Anyway, so what's going on in the news? I see John Huntsman has come out in support of gay marriage.
Yes, he actually wrote it in a conservative magazine. And wrote a piece about it, and so Huntsman has come out in support, and the White House may actually do a friend of the court briefing for the Supreme Court on this issue when it comes up. Believe it or not, the Supreme Court decided to hear its arguments right during Passover. Give me a break.
No accounting for that, but this is over Proposition 8, right?
That's right.
Because, you know, when I saw this, I go, wow, the Republicans, it looks like some in the Republican Party are trying to walk away from this. They're trying to walk back from the years of insanity because I think they've finally realized that the younger generations don't care. People like me and younger don't care.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting. I'm at my brother-in-law's house in California right now doing Washington News, but I believe in truth and advertising, and he actually is the world expert on millennials. And he said, when you look at the generational issues on gay marriage, they just like laugh at him if he speaks at a university. Why is this even coming up?
Yeah, the party has got to see that the stance they've taken to keep us divided. And I see this. Look, this is nothing but a divisive issue. This is the shiny thing in the room to get working class people to go, well, we're going to side with them, even though they're screwing me every chance they get. At least they're for taking rights away from others.
Right. Can you imagine?
I go back to about 10 or 12 years ago, I was doing this run up to, I was driving a truck for a living, and I was going up into Massachusetts. And the guy that I was, we were talking on the CB, going up together, we'd stopped for lunch, and it came up on TV, their gay marriage issue. And he goes, they're going to ruin the sanctity of my marriage. And I'm going, you know, how are two people you're never going to meet and never involve you, how are they going to ruin the sanctity of your marriage? I go, what about the girlfriend and the baby you have in Massachusetts? Do you think your wife and two kids back in Pennsylvania, do you think that might have anything to do with ruining the sanctity of your marriage? And there was just kind of a blank look on his face because hadn't really thought of that one.
Right, exactly.
I'm of the mindset, whatever consenting adults would do within the confines of their four walls, God bless them, they should have the same rights to be miserable as everybody else.
Well, you know, it's funny. I ran into a congressman, this is before Massachusetts passed gay marriage in 04, so it had to be 03 or so. I ran into two members of Congress going back to Washington on a late night plane, probably a Monday night going back, and they were talking about gay marriage, and of course they knew me and everything, and they said, well, I would think the right would love gay marriage. I mean, everybody knows once you get married, that ends your sexual interest.
I've said that 1,000 times. You know it ends. So, but no, it's not about that. Because for me, it really comes back down to the economic part. They really don't want to have to extend benefits. They really don't want to have to give tax breaks. They want any part of that. To me, it's always been the economic argument. Because the right has always told me that they're fairly libertarian, want government out of my life. Yet they're
right.
Pretty,
well, then
pretty
you
good.
Have to be consistent about it.
They're pretty good at putting a square inside people's bedrooms on so
That's
many levels.
Sure.
Anyway, I'll be happy when this is a gone issue.
I will too.
Because
and will in about 10 years.
Then we can start talking about what's really gone wrong in this country and how the very well-to-do have screwed the working class. And I don't know if you've seen the reports coming out, all of these different studies done by Sayas, the guy there at Berkeley, showing, you know, the recovery happened. It's just that people who work for a living, well, they didn't actually share in that recovery.
It didn't do the old Reagan trickle-down.
I got trickle-down all right, but there was no money involved. So let's go on. What's the sequestration? The president and the Republicans talking?
Well, the president actually reached out to the Speaker, Boehner, and to Minority Leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell. The White House did release some figures today showing that President Obama reduced the deficit over 10 years by $2.5 trillion. The president is now saying he wants a vote on his budget.
As he should have. And, you know, the reality in this is you look, the reason the budget is coming down is because, well, the economy is a little bit healthier. People are getting back to work. Maybe if we had an actual jobs bill to put more people back to work, you would have that snowball thing upward instead of pursuing this insanity called austerity that we're looking across the pond and going, not working for Europe. Why would we want to follow the same bad policies?
That's a good question. But anyway, that is where the president, he believes that they should do a vote on his budget, that the reason he's extending this budget is because he doesn't want it dead on arrival. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, so is this a blink on the president's part?
I'm not quite sure. I think it may be the stick.
Because, you know, I look at this and, you know, we're days away from the dreaded sequestration, the end of civilization as we know it, another crisis. I love all these crises. It makes for a good TV series. Not such good for public policy, but a good TV series.
It would be a good TV series, right?
Yeah, the sad reality is it would be a good TV series, but this is how we're running our country, and there's something seriously wrong.
I understand. It's like West Wing is a lot more sane than... West Wing, the TV series, was a lot more sane than what really happened.
Yeah. I see the president's approval ratings are at a three-year high?
They are at a three-year high, 55%. Some people still have some doubts about the fiscal issues, but this president is getting a much better pass than other places.
Yeah, I was talking to my uncle, who is a fairly well-to-do businessman who lives in the greater Cleveland area, and, boy, just one of the biggest anti-Obama people has bought into the whole, he's a socialist, and, you know, all of this stuff. He's anti-business, and I go, but, you know, businesses have never been doing better. In fact, your business, not doing better. You just told me minutes ago, growing and expanding and all of this stuff, but Obama's a socialist, and he's destroying business. And is it that they really believe this, or is that just the message that is being put out there, I wonder? Because I look at profits through the roof, CEO salaries through the roof. Everybody seems to be fat and happy on Wall Street. I know working people struggling a little bit, a lot. But, you know, the business folks, very happy. Business friendly, very friendly. In fact, Penny Pritzker, as Commerce Secretary, how much more business friendly can you get?
You can't, although I have to confess, truth and honesty, my cousin is actually married to a Pritzker.
Well, that's, again, not my. So are we in favor of her as
Commerce
Secretary?
But don't forget, I have another cousin that ran as senator in Ohio as a right winger. You know, we have all kinds in our
family. Hey, you choose your friends.
Right.
So is what it is. I see the First Lady and Big Bird doing a PSA. What's that about?
They are doing a big PSA. This is actually on food, and it's the same kind of theme that we're going to see for the Easter egg roll. Again, healthy eating, et cetera. The Easter egg rolls never really had themes until recently, and now everything's a theme.
Okay, so is this the theme? Is this a Michelle Obama thing? Is something she's going to be blamed for?
Yeah, it's a Michelle Obama food thing, yeah.
Okay, so the food Nazis are coming to get us because of her, right?
That's right.
They're not taking chocolate away from Easter because, you know, Easter and, you know, the death of Christ and the whole, you know, supposed holiday.
Right.
You know, chocolate's very important to that. And the bunny, I'm not quite sure how the bunny plays into it, but I know the bunny's important.
The bunny is very important, right? But this year it's probably going to be a vegetable bunny.
Oh, come on. A vegetable bunny?
A vegetable bunny.
That's going to ruin the whole thing. Just going to ruin it. Easter's done. I'm going to agree with the right wing on this. Michelle Obama is trying to destroy Easter just like they were trying to destroy Christmas. So now there's a war on Easter. I have just given the right wing a new meme. There you go.
A war on Easter. You're right.
Here it comes. I see a letter written on behalf about Senator Hagel.
That's right. 16 senators are saying he's got to go. It's probably not going to happen. But that is what's happening. And his old friend John McCain is not going for that.
Okay, good. And finally, the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce have come
together and issued a statement. They have come together. And what they're saying basically is that they're going to have immigration. They're going to give jobs to Americans first, but they're going to also put together a committee which is going to say what kind of job needs are needed in the United States. Of course, they didn't talk about any path to citizenship, so they're kicking some cans down the road.
Yeah. The question is Americans get those jobs first? What if they're crummy wage jobs that no American can survive on? Then do we pass those along?
Oh, that's the question of the day. Yeah. And, you know, my nephew's been working with trying to unionize some and help some of the tomato workers, et cetera. And, of course, they're now, you know, saying, well, these Americans aren't going to take these jobs. Well, yeah, they're not.
Yeah, we had a story up north in one of our affiliate listening areas where a guy had said, like a local farmer had said that, well, I can't get people to come and pick my, you know, I think it was tomatoes or apples or whatever. And he goes, I pay $10 an hour and I can't get people, Americans don't want to do this. And he was flooded and inundated with people saying, I'd do it for $10 an hour. And then when
exactly.
You find out what the $10 an hour were, it was, you know, the housing expenses because, you know, he doesn't pay him actual wages. He gives him a shack to live in and some slop to eat and a couple of bucks. It
right.
Wasn't $10 an hour.
Of course not.
Anyway.
That's how it goes.
And
that's today for you.
And that's today's news. Ellen Ratner, I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Have a great one.
You too. Enjoy California. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. This land we have defended from all things that grow. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
In late 2012, researchers at the National Marine Mammal Foundation published their acoustic analysis of the voice of a whale that apparently can imitate a human voice. Here's what he sounds like from an audio track made by scientist Sam Ridgway and his team, courtesy of the journal Current Biology.
That sound is coming from a beluga, or white whale, named Nock. He lived in an enclosure at the National Marine Mammal Foundation, among dolphins and other white whales. He'd often been in the presence of humans. Researchers working near him sometimes thought they heard another person talking. They were surprised to find the voice was coming from the whale.
That was in 1984. Prior to that time, there had been anecdotal reports of whales sounding like humans, but no real evidence or analysis. Scientists at the National Marine Mammal Foundation recorded the whale's sounds. They found a rhythm similar to human speech and fundamental frequencies several octaves lower than typical whale sounds.
They said the observations suggest it wasn't easy for the whale to make these sounds. And that, they said, suggests motivation for contact on the part of the whale. For more about Nock, the whale with a human voice, come to EarthSky.org. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Life can be a challenge. Life can seem impossible. It's never easy when there's so much on the line. But you and I can make a difference.
Yes, I sure miss. I miss Herman. I there's part of me that goes, he would have been. I think he'd have been an entertaining president, if nothing else. A little entertainment. I mean, as long as you're getting the shaft, you might as well be laughing while doing it, right? Maybe not. But yeah, we talked with Saru Jayaraman, who wrote the book Behind the Kitchen Door. And again, you can get that at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Saru's name, it'll take you there. But, you know, pointing out the fact that the Herman Cain train, very influential in holding down workers' wages. You know, back during the 90s as head of the NRA, as she said, the other NRA, the National Restaurant Association, making sure 21 years, no increase in the minimum wage for tipped employees. That's really something. I guess power. I mean, stop and think about it. How much power a group, very few people even know it exists, how much power they've got. Wow. Anyway, a couple days, we're closing in on the end of the month, right? And the grand, I guess it's as of what, 7 days, I guess, right? Till the end of civilization, till the sequester takes effect. And you look at this and you go, how did we get here? You know, how did we create another crisis? And this was one of those things that came out of the Republican hostage crisis, the debt ceiling debacle of the summer of 2011. And what always sticks in my mind is, the Republicans are holding us hostage for something they did with regularity. In fact, 19 times during the Bush years, they raised the debt limit without any squawking. Nothing. 19 times. And yet, the Republicans who are really screaming about this now, not a word. And in fact, we talk with Bob Ney occasionally, former congressman, who said, you know, it was a yawn vote. We'd go in, we'd do our thing, and, well, cast the vote and go play golf. Now it's turned into a crisis. And we've got to have these really draconian, you know, you set up the big super committee, which we knew from the beginning was going to be a failure. I've got to get the grand bargain. No grand bargain. especially when one side has dug in and said, we're not raising revenue. No way, no how, not happening. So this whole sequester is the result of their failure to come to the grand bargain, their failure for the super committee to do their job. So they passed this Budget Control Act, which, you know, you go, that's a really nice name. So we passed this Budget Control Act with really the intention, and I believe the intention by Republicans who pushed for it, to hold us hostage like this. So what's going to happen? Well, I mean, you're going to see these automatic spending cuts come into place. If it gets to this, as of Monday, when they come back, going to be, 5 days until the end of the month, until this is all supposed to happen. Maybe, you know, the last minute, you know, ticking bomb, you know, crisis, American people all worked up. Well, we'll push it off another couple of months. Or maybe they're just going to let it happen. And then what happens? Well, you're going to see unemployed workers losing their benefits. It's going to happen. You're going to see social safety net programs stop. You're going to see, you know, the president push for early childhood education. Deep cuts there. There'll be cuts to funding for law enforcement, cuts to funding for border security. Cuts to airline security, cuts to food safety, you name it. There are going to be cuts across the board. Slash and burn type austerity. And, of course, there are going to be defense cuts, which means, you know, a lot of jobs are going to be lost all along the whole thing. Now, there's a study done, you know, saying, hey, you know, what's going to happen when we gut Head Start? What's going to happen when we gut disaster relief? What's going to happen to our economy? Now, there have been some independent reports who have said, look, you're going to see over the year, you're going to see, well, economic growth reduced by about 0.6%. About 700,000 jobs lost in the process. You can kiss that recovery goodbye. That could end us right back into another recession. But, hey, austerity is working so well over in Europe. We should do the same thing here. So they came up with the austerity plan, the grand sequester, for something that they did 19 times during the Bush years. And someone says, well, you know, how do we stop it? How can we avoid the pain? Well, you undo what it is you've done, because this is not a mandatory crisis. This is a made-up crisis, another one, another manufactured, created crisis, another mirage, if you will. The problem is they've created this crisis. It's got very real consequences. And who's it going to hurt? It's going to hurt you and me. Unemployment through the roof. So what have the states been doing to prepare for this? Well, I look at North Carolina, who signed probably one of the more draconian unemployment insurance, quote-unquote, reforms. It's going to cut benefits, reduce the maximum weekly benefit from 535 down to 530, going to cut the maximum number of weeks down to 20, which means immediately 170,000 people there in North Carolina, done. Average worker in this country who's been unemployed, average 35 weeks. Their program is going to be 20. What's that going to mean? Desperation Nation. This is where they're taking us, folks. And this sequester, more part of it. More part of it. It's an absolute shame. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. The must is coming.